This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on Thursday, November 13th, 2008. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Open session of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, November 13th, 2008 will now come to order. Mr. Vice Chair, first item on the agenda is correction and approval of minutes.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I move for approval of agenda document number 0833, the minutes for the October 23rd, 2008 open session.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion passes 6-0. Thank you. Second item on the agenda, draft advisory opinion 2008-14. I'm going to pronounce it Malothe. Maybe Malothe. We've gone around the ring as to how to pronounce it, but for the purposes of this, we'll say Malothe. Office of General Counsel.
Yes, thanks again, Mr. Chairman. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents number 0839, number 0839A, and number 0839B. One is an unlabeled draft, one is draft B, and one is draft C in the document.
Without objection. So ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Before you are three alternative advisory opinion drafts that respond to a request filed on behalf of Malothe, Inc. For convenience, I will refer to the first draft released on Monday as Draft A, the second draft released earlier this morning as Draft B, and a third draft released shortly before this meeting as Draft C. Malothe, a for-profit corporation, is seeking to launch and operate an internet TV station covering the campaigns of one or more federal candidates. Malothe envisions producing and transmitting live and pre-recorded programming daily from the campaign's headquarters. This programming would be viewable for free by the general public through Malothe's website. The content likely would be supportive of Democratic candidates, at least initially, and it will be of particular interest to campaign supporters and volunteers. Malothe, however, would prepare the content and retain editorial control over the content on its website. Malothe asks two questions. First, it asks whether its proposed internet campaign TV station qualifies for the press exemption. Second, if the commission answers yes, Malothe asks whether the proposed website may include solicitations on behalf of the featured federal candidates. On the first question, drafts A and B conclude that most of Malothe's proposed activities would qualify for the press exemption. Malothe would not be owned or controlled by political party, political committee, or candidate, and it would be engaging primarily in legitimate press functions, such as providing interviews, daily news reports, roundtable discussions, coverage of campaign events, speeches and rallies, and political commentary. Although most of Malothe's proposed activities would be legitimate press functions, there is insufficient information to definitively conclude whether Malothe's proposal to brief campaign volunteers and recognize outstanding local volunteers and their activities would qualify for the press exemption. Draft B changes some of the language and analysis from Draft A while reaching the same conclusion. Draft C, on the other hand, concludes that Malothe would engage in activities that are not within the legitimate press function of a media entity. Consequently, under Draft C, Malothe's proposed activities would not be encompassed by the press exemption. On the second question, drafts A and B conclude that, under limited circumstances, solicitations on behalf of featured candidates may be included. Draft C concludes the second question is moot because it answers no on the first question. The Commission received one comment on the advisory opinion request, but no comments on any of the drafts. I will be happy to address any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any discussion, thoughts? Multiple drafts here. You want to go?
Sure.
Commissioner Weintraub steps up to the plate.
If nobody else wants to talk, I'll always talk,
always,
Mr. Chairman.
Always, you know, always ready to go.
I'm always a volunteer. I think this is a hard question. And I, first of all, want to really express my appreciation to all of my colleagues who I think work very hard to together to try and find a consensus on this. Because it raises difficult questions about the scope of the press exemption and the line between where a press entity stops and a PR arm of the campaign starts. The law is very clear on the press exemption that it's and it's obviously an important part of the First Amendment. And we've certainly seen press entities that no one would contest were anything but press entities who do things like inside reports from campaigns. So a number of the activities that were suggested here are quite typical activities. So how do we distinguish when the requester admits that they're coming in with a bias? Well, bias can't be the determining factor because a lot of press entities are biased. You know, depending on what you like to listen to, you can listen to Hannity and Combs, you can listen to Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann, you can listen to Rush Limbaugh, you can listen, you know, that you could go on and on with a list of people that one might listen to. If you like people who are a little bit more feisty, you could choose between Chris Matthews or John McLaughlin and find, you know, whatever your flavor you like to listen to out there on what are indisputable media entities. So bias can't be the determining factor, because I don't think anybody would say that any of those folks aren't functioning as part of media enterprises and that their comments aren't covered by the press exemption. And I think what it comes down to is independence. And in some ways, this answer, and I suppose I should say which draft I'm supporting here, being a moderate, middle-of-the-road type of person, I'm going for draft B. Which I think is in some ways a compromise, but I think it's a good one. In some ways, it doesn't really answer the key questions. We're taking the requester's word for it on some of the key issues here, which is, are they really independent? Are they going to be controlled by the candidates or the political party? And are they going to be functioning with real independent editorial control? They say they will, and they haven't started up yet, so we don't have any facts really on the table that would help us decide whether they really will or they won't. So we're just taking their word for it, and the opinion here is premised on their being straight with us and that they will be independent. If in fact, as they go forward, they're not independent, then this opinion isn't going to do them any good, because like any opinion, it's premised on the facts that we're given. But I think that if they do maintain that independence, then, as I said, a number of their activities sort of inside the campaign scoops are not that different from press activities that have been going on for a long time in campaigns. Some of them we couldn't quite see how those quite fit into the standard press activities. So we couldn't really give them an answer on the briefings for the volunteers or the recognition of outstanding local volunteers. You wouldn't normally see the New York Times recognizing on their own behalf outstanding volunteers in their favorite campaigns. And the solicitations, I think, you know, depends on how extensive they're going to be doing that. We do conclude in draft B that they can't have a permanent feature of their website that has a hyperlink to campaign contribution pages. So I think that it's a difficult question, and I think we've done the best that we can in trying to resolve it, and I believe that we have a consensus on it, and I think that in and of itself is cause for celebration. So I will be supporting draft B.
Thank you. Envisioning the celebration. Any other thoughts?
Mr. Chairman, this is one of the hardest decisions that I've had in a long time, because it involves our policy that the internet should be as open as possibly as possible, subject to whatever reasonable constraints of the campaign finance laws must be imposed, and we've said that quite clearly in our ENJ when we adopted rules relating to the internet, which were basically, there are some rules, but not many. And also because the sweeping nature of the request was, to me, quite broad, and we've not defined for ourselves really what is a press entity and what isn't, and this certainly comes up against the very edges of traditional notions of what a press entity would be. And it's certainly not in the statute contemplated directly that a 24-hour internet program or series of programs is within the context of something that's broadcast or printed or a periodical. Certainly a periodical assumes that it's going to be periodically and not 24 hours of constant communication. So I was troubled with that and the fact that where do we draw our limits on what is a press entity and what isn't? And for that reason, I was supportive and still believe that the most appropriate decision if we were going to do something to give guidance would be to adopt what's been identified, I think, as Agenda Document B, but it's really on the document adopted number C, which has basically said we do not have a press entity here under these circumstances, the sweeping request in the letter itself. Now, B, which Commissioner Weintraub just referred to, cut some limits into that that seem to make it certainly more acceptable. And I have to confess that there was a strong effort here to try and find consensus, and I think we all need to try to do that whenever we can, so I'll vote for B. But I think if we were going to get into regulation on the field, which I don't see us doing for quite some time, and to try and define a press entity and try and carve out what can be done or what might be too far, then my inclination would be our best answer is to say no. And I think the reform community really did make some very persuasive points on where the outer reaches of this might be way beyond what we want to see in terms of campaign finance regulation. But I will support B, and it is great to see this and have a consensus and bring this back and limit it to some degree as B does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My remarks will be very brief. I agree with much of what Commissioners Weintraub and Vice Chair Walter had to say. I think that this issue wasn't an easy one. I think that it did, as Commissioner Weintraub pointed out well, there is that line, where does a press entity end and a campaign media arm begin? And this does forced us to try to examine where that line is a little bit more closely. And it wasn't an easy issue, and if it was an easy issue, I'm assuming we wouldn't have gotten the advisory opinion request in the first place. However, I think that I agree with my colleagues. I think draft B takes the best approach to this. I think it's a common sense approach, I think. And it is premised on that the representations in the request are accurate, and if they weren't, then we'd have to reconsider it at a later time. But for many of the same reasons that have been expressed by my colleagues, I too am prepared to support draft B.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree that this is a difficult question, and I think that we are going to be faced with more like this, because as technology evolves and the internet evolves, I think creative people will find lots of interesting ways to communicate messages to the public, and I think that's an important part of the process and something that we will are challenged to find ways to fit our existing regulations with respect to limits on corporations into these new ideas. But I think that's an important job for us to do, because I think those innovations are critical to how people communicate in their political process. I think we've just been through a process where maybe some of us are glad that all of the ads are over, but certainly they were in many medium, both on, you know, all over the TV and the internet and radio and phone calls. And I think that that diversity of message opportunities is important to our political process. I think that as Commissioner Peterson just said, we take these representations about the operation of this entity, and that is what I think gives many of us comfort to find this space for them in draft B, that they can engage in some of these activities within the press exemption, because if these things, if we find that there is control going on with respect from a campaign or a candidate, obviously that changes the facts of the AO, and wouldn't provide them with any protection. So I think that the concerns raised about the scope of this or the slippery slope of this are limited by the representations in the request itself and the limitations in and the application of the AO based on those representations. The limits that we've identified in the daily briefings and awards for volunteers, and I think very importantly in the solicitation area, are reason to find that this is the right line between these two ideas. So I will also be supporting draft B. Thank you.
I agree with the comments that the sentiment that this is not an easy question. The press exemption is that it's an exemption, it's not an exception. So presumably the press would be doing conduct which would be a violation of FECA or BCRA, but for the exemption. But an exemption is I see it as a jurisdictional limitation, not an exception to the law. That being said, though, I mean, the McConnell Court made clear, and we I think we added it to draft B, I think it was a good add, that the press exemption does not afford carte blanche to media companies generally to avoid the limits and the prohibitions of FECA. I think that's important language. And page 6 is a sentence, line 10 and 11, however, not every entity that operates a website on the internet is a press or media entity. So I don't want anyone to think that this is a green light to anything goes, because to me the real tension is you have the real media entities that are already established that do this sort of thing. I remember before the election on Yahoo, I saw a snippet that was live from Norm Coleman's campaign headquarters. No complaints came in on that, because I don't think anyone was going to challenge Yahoo News, because it's Yahoo News and everyone kind of knows Yahoo's already out there. This group, though, isn't. They're new, and we shouldn't deny someone the ability to be a media entity simply because they haven't been a media entity yet and they're just starting up. It sort of puts a cart and a horse kind of situation where they don't get to be a media entity until they're already done things that break the law and then become a media entity. So I think that deciding things at the threshold for these folks, I think, are important. The other hand, what you don't want to have happen, obviously, is a kind of a fake media entity where you could just imagine maxed out donors are sort of directed or invest in this sort of outside company, and then they, you know, essentially becomes a soft money arm of the campaign. You know, it's a potential massive loophole that I don't think this draft B, which I support as well, it gets anywhere near opening up. There's certainly I could certainly envision other drafts that could go down that road, but this draft I don't think does. And if anyone reads it that way, I would suggest that they read it closer and take the comments that we're making up here to heart. For example, the two issues that really caught my eye. Well, the one issue didn't catch my eye was that they're only really going to broadcast about Democrats. I don't really have a problem with that. I think, as Commissioner Weintraub noted, everyone has a point of view, and even things that we can certainly consider to be mainstream news tend to come at things from different perspectives, and merely because you want to flack for one side over the other, to me, isn't the sort of thing that we the U.S. government need to arbitrate. But that being said, the business about it's somewhat confusing to me on this volunteer business where they're going to broadcast in the morning and kind of let the volunteer know what to do. I don't think we're giving a real crisp answer on that. I think we're saying if we're reading the opinion correctly, it's okay. But if a group like this simply just becomes an arm of the campaign, it gets to the control issue, where essentially the campaign is saying, okay, here's what you're going to broadcast today on the news for us and tell our volunteers what precincts we're going to walk. I think that takes you out of the media exception. But if it's more of a newscast of what's already happening in a campaign or a party committee or a rally or whatever, I think that's okay. Same with the solicitations. I couldn't really see a legitimate news source actually themselves having the anchor solicit money. I mean, perhaps maybe they could, but I think there's a distinction between that and if they interview someone who's with the campaign, they say, if you want to help us, go to www.giveusmoney.com, and that sort of thing. So I think these are tough issues that really turn on facts And at the AO stage, my sense is the consensus up here is this is an AO. We take AO requesters at their word. But as Commissioner Weintraub noted, if you get kind of outside of the representations in the AO, you don't necessarily end up in the protection of the AO. At least that was kind of the inference I took, and I agree with that. So I'm also in support of draft B, and I do want to thank everyone up here for coming together and trying to find a way to acknowledge the ability of folks to be a media entity, but yet not have an anything goes system that could invite larger problems. You know, simply because you have a website doesn't necessarily mean it's always anything goes. But at this point, without any other comments, maybe we have a motion on the draft. Yes.
Question that's raised by some of your comments, because I think some of what was going on here in this drafting was people trying to infer where other people would want to be, and I take to heart and agree with your comment that you wouldn't normally see anchors soliciting on, you know, NBC News or whatever. We do have in draft B on page 10, line 11. It says nothing prohibits Malothe's commentators, guests, and hosts to make express advocacy endorsements of certain candidates and concurrently to suggest that they could contribute. And I wonder if maybe we should take out "and hosts" and just limit that to commentators and guests.
It's up to you. I'm fine either way. Because when I read the sentence, the second part of the sentence, 13 and 14, where it says, so long as neither Malothe Inc. nor its website is owned or controlled by any candidate, political party, or political committee. If they truly are acting independent of the campaign, I guess the host could say so. But if it's sort of a script handed to them by the campaign, I think the control issue comes up. So I'm really fine either way. And it's less than clear to me from the AO request, did they envision the host actually doing it or just the host asking guests, what do you think about the campaign? And the guests would say, I think it's great, give them money.
Well, if you're okay either way and there would be the votes for it, I'd be happy to take out "and hosts" and make it just limited to commentators and guests, which I think would be more consistent with the way most media entities do operate.
I don't necessarily oppose. The reason I was able to support the draft as is sort of in line 15, it talks about where it does not become a regular feature, talking about solicitations, that there was a presumption that I read that as if a host, so long as that doesn't become, you know, every 30 minutes, like station identification, oh, by the way, let me remind you, go
becomes a telethon.
Yeah, go you know, contribute to the candidate that we're hyping at this particular moment. So long as it was infrequent, I don't necessarily have a problem. But if there's if the, you know, the others of my colleagues felt like they wanted to take that out, I'd also find that as well.
Okay. So also, there was a MER that was sort of related to this a couple of years ago. Radio show had a candidate on, and the radio show actually did a live broadcast from the incumbent member of Congress's campaign headquarters, and they were very clear on that they wanted this person fired, was the term they used, and they really, and that, you know, the hosts of the radio show were very clear that they didn't like this guy and they wanted him gone, and they brought on his opponent, and the opponent gave out the information for the campaign and solicited money and that kind of thing, and the host kind of egged it on and also helped with it. So I want to make sure that something the commission's already done doesn't get stepped on by this AO, but in this case, happy to take out hosts. But a lot of this has really kind of already been decided in a MER that I thought had some merit because, well, I filed the complaint. So it kind of shows where I maybe really am on the issue, but, you know, I also am of the school that once we kind of go one way, we have to sort of keep going that way unless we go through a rulemaking or that kind of thing. And as a vice chair noted, I don't, given all the other work we need to do, I don't see that happening anytime in the near future. But if we want to take out hosts, that's fine. if a host does make some sort of express advocacy or solicitation, I don't think that's a violation in and of itself. It's, I think it becomes more of a fact issue, but.
I think you're right. I think that if it happened on an infrequent occurrence, but I think that by taking it out, we convey that we don't expect to see this being run like a telephone, and that might be a better message. So given the discussion at the table, I'm going to move that we, on page 10, line 11 of draft B, which is actually called 0839A, the agenda document number, that we delete the comma after commentators, insert the word and, delete the comma after guests, and delete the words and hosts, and otherwise approve the draft, along with any technical and conforming amendments that may be necessary. Well, I doubt it.
Okay.
Okay.
That's the motion?
Yes, that's the motion.
All right. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Passes 6-0. Next up, we have some audits. First is the report from the Audit Division on Edwards for President. I believe it's 2004 run. Okay. Mr. Faven, how are you?
Good. I'm very good. Good afternoon. I'm Marty Faven. This is Erica Lee. It's my pleasure to present to you the report of the Audit Division on Edwards for President. 2004 Principal Campaign Committee for Senator John Edwards, a candidate for the Democratic Party's nomination for the office of president. The audit resulted in the following findings: net outstanding campaign obligations, receipt of contributions that exceed the limits, receipt of in-kind contributions that exceed the limits, transfer of apparent ineligible funds from Edwards for Senate, and stale dated checks. And we'll be glad to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Got a bunch of objections on this one. Would you like to lead it off?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concern was with respect to finding four. With respect to the funds that were eligible for transfer. It's a narrow issue. There were several areas of several types of funds that were deemed ineligible for transfer. My concern is with, in particular, the funds received from the sale of the committee's assets, the Senate committee's assets to the presidential campaign. My concern is that I don't find in the transfer regs any limits on funds to be made up of contributions only. Here, the Senate campaign sold assets to the presidential campaign, I believe, in February of the year prior to the of the year of the transfer, which happened, I believe, in September. The funds received from the sale were in the Senate campaign as the date of the transfer, and I see no basis on which to exclude them from the sale of the assets. I think, importantly, the regs do require some scrutiny with respect to the contributions that are being transferred to ensure that the transfer of contributions doesn't result in any excessive transfers, but I don't see any similar basis on which to look at any other funds that might be eligible. So my perspective would be that funds should be broader than just contributions, and in particular in this case, because I note that the response from the committee to the preliminary audit report, noted that had the assets been transferred at a later date, at which point the Senate committee would have been defunct is the wrong word, would have been closed because the senator had had declared that he was no longer seeking that candidacy for the Senate. They could have transferred those assets to the presidential campaign. So the fact that the presidential campaign winds up with both the hard assets like computers and their money back as a result of the transfer of those proceeds doesn't concern me. I agree that there may remain an issue with respect to the payments received for shared space or rent or those sorts of things. That money may need to be segregated out. But my view is that, my concern is that this approach that's taken in this audit report wouldn't distinguish between this case where the assets were sold to a related campaign and if they had been sold to an unrelated entity. If the Senate campaign had decided to put these assets up on eBay and sold them, those funds would have been a part of the campaign. And this approach, which looks only at contributions, wouldn't allow for those assets to be transferred as well. So those are my concerns with that approach with respect to the funds available for the transfer.
Okay.
Answer you want us all to sort of talk and
go ahead.
It's whatever you prefer, really. I have a similar concern, but my concerns actually go beyond that. Basically, three areas. First is more of a general issue of process, which is really beyond scope of what team audit does. So this is not really directed at anyone in particular, but it is illustrated by what Commissioner Bowerly just said, and that a lot of audit reports, particularly this one, turns on predicate legal issues. Sometimes they're cases of first impression, sometimes they're novel, sometimes they're not, sometimes they're straightforward, sometimes they're complex, sometimes they're simple. But ultimately, those who get audited, it's always struck me as odd that the commission does these audits and the recipient of the audit, in this case, the Edwards for President Committee, doesn't really get a chance to also present in this sort of thing. This has come up before I get to the commission, it'll probably come up again. But as a matter of process, this is an example of something that maybe we could, at some point, allow a little more of an opportunity to be heard, particularly in cases like this where it's legal issues. And this is not an easy legal issue. And having read the sort of narrative responses provided by the Edwards for President campaign, it certainly only made it more complicated, not more straightforward. Here you have a variety of legal theories, I think, that could apply to this to finding four. First, and they each would have really dramatically different results. There's the one in the audit report itself, which really looks at it as a net debt rule. And as I understand it, the senator had debt from his 98 race, which was owed to himself personally. He then raised debt retirement money, retired that debt essentially, and then forgave the debt to himself and took that money essentially transferred to his presidential run.
Right.
Each individual link in that chain is, I think, perfectly legal. Assuming you buy into the assumption before you transfer the money, the assumption being it was actually excess campaign funds. And that's really the issue, is once you do the debt retirement, can you repay that debt back again? Well, he could or he couldn't, I guess. I think what's odd is it's debt to himself, so he could repay the debt to himself and then take the money and put it right back into his presidential campaign, which brings me to the second legal theory, which really isn't addressed in the audit. He could do that, but for the fact he took matching funds, right? He's limited to 50 grand self-funding in that, so this was a way to sort of get the money into the presidential campaign before hitting the $50,000 threshold. And that's a legal issue that really hasn't, I don't think, been fleshed out. Third issue is the one Commissioner Bowerly raises, can we use just contributions, or is it contributions plus other monies raised by the campaign for selling off assets or whatnot? I don't see a good reason why that's not a viable legal theory. And I'm stating that in the negative, which will become clear in a minute, but generally, all these legal theories, I can't find any real clear precedent for applying one over the other. And I think as a campaign, I sympathize Edwards for President's predicament, that they saw a way to move money, and they did, and there's really nothing in the regs, I think, that clearly prohibits what they did. But there is 110.3C43, which is the kind of the transfer reg that seems to be much more specific than the theory advanced in the audit. So that's an elaborate way of asking, I think, a very broad question. And that is, how do we, when going through audits, decide the predicate legal theory? And when there's alternative theories, when's the judgment made and that kind of thing? I think Commissioner Bowerly makes some good points on her theory, but it's just one of, I think, several theories that lead to either Edwards having done nothing wrong or done a lot of things wrong. And I don't see a clear path that one really trumps the other necessarily. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, and of course that's why we get a legal analysis done and to see which one to apply in each particular situation. Wanda, do you have anything? Or?
Well, usually it's based on prior experience and as Marty said, we get a legal opinion about it before we send something up. And it's usually based on us reviewing sometimes the E&J and to see how the same principles were applied in a previous audit.
Has this issue come up before in previous audit?
This one's fairly unique as far as my experience. I don't think we've really seen anything quite like this one. Joe?
I think that's correct. We haven't seen this issue a lot in audits. Certainly not with the complexity that goes with this one. And as Wanda said, we read the regs, we read the past precedent. We and counsel spent more than a little time together before we did the analysis, trying to agree on what the best approach was. And out of all that came what you have before you.
So do I take it then that the analysis, the legal analysis in the audit report is consistent with what general counsel?
Yes, that's correct.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay.
I would say, Mr. Chairman, I think what we've said in the analysis, which is at the back of the final audit report, is that it's an open question whether you should look at funds or merely contributions. And in response to that, our colleagues in the audit division produced the cover memo of this report, which looked at it. We did suggest in our comments the commission should consider alternatives, and our colleagues in the audit division ran the numbers looking at all funds rather than just contributions. And when you look at all funds, you then have to make a determination whether you're going to exclude the amount that could arguably result in an excessive contribution from the presidential but the Senate committee, the asset sale portion, or whether you're going to just exclude all of the other recently received funds. And as you noted, Mr. Chairman, you get some pretty different results depending on which of those paths you go down. I would just say as well, in terms of the process and in connection with the question of the excess campaign funds, that while a number of you are seeing this for the first time and the public is seeing this for the first time at the final audit report stage, some of these issues, and that was one in particular, we spent a fair amount of time, not just between ourselves and the audit division, but the commission did as well at the interim audit report stage.
That's helpful. unfortunately, though, for Edwards for president, that what the public sees for the first time is the recommended final audit report.
But Edwards for president does get to see the interim audit report, preliminary, and respond to it.
That is true, and they disagreed with that quite strenuously, as I recall. The real problem I have with finding four is although it feels like something that should be a problem, and probably something if I were, although I obviously wasn't, you know, an attorney scrubbing this, I probably would have given me some pause. Doesn't necessarily mean I would have said no, but it certainly, to me, that raises the issue of, well, how can we now, particularly in an audit, which essentially declares they violated the law, say they did so when it's not entirely clear to me that it was a clear illegal course that they took to move the money. But I kind of understand the argument, but it kind of bootstraps a couple of concepts together. I'm struggling with why the Edwards for President folks would know this was illegal at the time they did what they did. That's for anybody. We don't have a past audit that says this is not a good idea. We don't have a past MER that says it's a bad idea, right? We don't have an AO. We don't have a reg. What do we have? We have, for the future, maybe it should be a bad idea, but when they did it, I don't see on the books that it was a bad idea.
Chairman, I think you have a good point with respect to, I think there are some concepts that has to be strung together. But I think the fact remains that they are there, and when you look at the fact that the regulation actually used the terms funds received, and in our analysis, we agree that we don't think that is limited to contributions. And then when you open it up, I mean, there are other things that should be considered. Mm-hmm. And so we agree with that as well. But when you get to the point of those other things, I think there may be a problem when you look at the assets that were sold. Because in fact, if for example, this transaction had occurred one day, then the next day, whereas they sold the assets, then the next day they turn around and transfer the money, I think we would look at it with a more suspicious eye. And I think the reason that it may not appear as a violation to us because there is a period of time in between the two transactions. But bottom line, I think.
I'm not quite following you. If the timing was different,
right?
Could you elaborate on why that matters?
If the timing was different, I think we would look at it with a more suspicious eye because we were saying, well, maybe they were trying to make a contribution to the presidential committee.
Oh, I see. Yes. Someone buying the goods,
yes,
or whatnot. It would be backdooring. Okay, got
exactly.
It. I understand that. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I think we're talking about two. Really, there's two major issues that you mentioned. One is the 98 debt retirement money, and while there may not be something that says on its four corners that you can't do this, the principle that we're trying to vindicate here is that we do have a reg that says you can't raise debt retirement money if you don't have any debt. So it's not a big leap from that to say that there is some restriction on the use of those particular funds, that you got to pay those, you got to use those funds to pay that debt. And if somebody waves a wand and that debt doesn't exist anymore, it's sort of like when you have raised general election funds and don't make the general election. You've got to give that money back. On the other issue, the issue of the asset sale, the committee did argue pretty vociferously in response to the preliminary audit report that the calculation ought to be funds rather than just contributions. And again, there are two ways you can go if you accept their argument on that, and one of them actually puts them in a worse position than they otherwise would be in. And colleagues in the audit division can elaborate on that.
Yeah, that is correct. If we consider all the funds transferable, the amount does favor the committee, but if the sale of assets is not allowed by the commission, then they end up in a worse position than they were before.
Just so I can track it, and forgive me, I'm getting over a cold, so I'm on cold medicine, so I have to slow it down a little bit today. So how does that square with Commissioner Bowerly's concerns?
Well, Commissioner Bowerly, her position was not to disallow the sale of assets, so it ends up with the committee in a better position.
Okay. That's what I thought. I just wanted to make sure. What's the legal argument again against doing it that way?
Well, the situation has to do with whether there's an in-kind contribution of returning the assets or returning the money.
At the point, sure.
Mr. Chairman, if I might elaborate on that a little bit. One of the things the regulation does tell us fairly clearly is when you transfer money, it's the most recent money that you receive that is transferred, and that can't cause a limitation problem. In this case, the most recent, or some of the most recent money received, was in fact the payment from the Presidential Committee to the Senatorial Committee for shared expenses and assets purchased. Now, those same assets couldn't be just moved without making an in-kind contribution. So the Presidential Committee correctly paid the Senatorial Committee. If the Senatorial Committee can then, working back through its most recent receipts, turn around and give the money back, you know, do we then have a contribution from one to the other that was avoided by the payment in the first place? And that's the theory in the cover memo that concludes that including funds, the broader definition, but excluding those asset purchases actually puts the committee in a worse position than if we just look at contributions.
Still hung up on the basic issue, though, that it seems that the rules were, to be kind, less than clear. It seems like the campaign saw some daylight and they took advantage of it. I don't think there's any doubt about that. How to move money from the Senate campaign over to the presidential campaign, retiring the debt, that kind of thing. But. This is someone mentioned this earlier. I didn't want to cut anybody off, but when they raised the debt retirement money, there was debt at the time that they raised the money, right? So they had debt, they raised debt retirement money. So the question is, do you then have to take that money and pay off the debt, or can you then forgive the debt? And what's unique about this case, it's a self-funding debt issue, which kind of raises our old friend Buckley, and you know, you have a right to give your money and all that kind of thing. Bicker has changed that to a certain extent. Not Buckley, obviously, but the amount which you can loan your campaign and get paid back. That's not impacted here, though, right? That's not a, there's no statutory limit on how much he could put into his campaign and pay himself back here, right? This is pre-Bicker. Right, okay. So I'm still hung up on something that
Mr. Chairman.
Seems fishy, but I can't put my finger on why it's actually illegal, at least why this commission's already said it's illegal before these folks acted.
One thing that may help with this is that in the net debt rule, when it talks about raising contributions after the fact to pay off debt from your campaign, I believe the rule goes on to say, as you decrease the amount of your debt, you can't raise any more money. And that seems to suggest that when you no longer have the debt, you're not supposed to be raising any money to do something else with it. Mm-hmm. And so at least that theory about as you begin to decrease the amount, you're supposed to limit that to actually, you're supposed to limit the amount you can solicit to what you actually have left. So that seems to suggest when you totally eliminate your debt, that you're not supposed to do something else with the money that you've raised.
Sort of, but it also could suggest another thing, which is you just can't keep raising debt retirement money. It has to relate back to the,
exactly,
to debt. You don't get to keep raising, you know, if you have $100,000 worth of debt, you can't keep raising money saying we still have debt. Right. It reduces the debt. But then it's a step in the analysis beyond that, right? Because then he did raise money consistent with that rule.
Right.
And then after that rule kind of ceased applying, and it, from one point of view, he then forgave the debt, which you can forgive debt. You see, each separate step in this is fine on its own. It's when you sort of bootstrap it together, all of a sudden it looks kind of funny. But looking funny and being funny are two different things, I think. But those are my thoughts on that. That's where I'm struggling on finding four, and that's why I'm having trouble supporting it because of the lack of clarity in the rule. Now, maybe this is something that I don't know if there's a way we announce from here on out this is something we can't do, but it just doesn't seem fair to the Edwards folks to say after the fact you can't do this after they did it. When I can sort of connect the dots and say I can sort of see what they were doing. You know, simply because it seems kind of funny, like I said, doesn't make it illegal. Certainly creative. But creative is not legally problematic unless it already is legally problematic. Mr. Weintraub?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I don't know whether you'll find this informative, persuasive, or anything else, but I just wanted to make sure that we were, in response to your previous question about how, you know, it's not illegal for him to put his own resources into his own campaign. That's true for the Senate campaign. It wouldn't be true for his presidential campaign because that was publicly funded.
And so right. I mentioned that at the $50,000 limit, yeah. which is, but that's not explored in the audit. Well, you could another analysis is he raises debt retirement money. Okay, he could, instead of forgiving the debt, okay, the senator could have just paid himself back this dollar amount. He could turn around and put it into a subsequent campaign. The problem is if he puts in this amount of money in a subsequent campaign, he blows through the $50,000 cap, right, takes him out of the matching funds regime.
Right.
But we're not really talking about that issue, I don't think. That doesn't seem to be fleshed out in the audit. I'm kind of wondering why. Because I raised it in my initial, you know, different legal theories that could apply to that. And if that legal theory gets applied, the campaign really has got a problem. Because then I guess you have to repay the entire matching funds amount. So why haven't we gone down that road?
Well, part of the theory was actually raised and discussed at the preliminary audit report stage. We discussed some of those theories about the impact on the $50,000 expenditure limitation for the candidate. So it's something that we have talked about and we have explored. It was something that we did at the preliminary audit report stage.
Okay.
So it was a theory that we explored.
Okay. So this has been a discussion before I got here, that enough people said, no, that's not, that dog doesn't hunt here. We'll get to find another theory. Any other thoughts on finding four? If not, I'd like to actually ask a couple questions about another finding. This is the excessive contribution finding, which is finding two. Thank you. Thank you. A bunch of people going two. Really a couple questions about sampling. And I think the final audit report makes clear that the dollar amount of issue is not really a metaphysically accurate number. It's based upon a projection. Which I think is the proper way to say this. You don't want to necessarily say that he has $200 some thousand dollars of excessive when it's really just a statistical model. And I think for audit purposes, I think that's fine. I'd have trouble imposing sort of a penalty necessarily based upon a statistical model, but for purposes of the audit, I think it's fine. But I want to get a sense a little bit about the methodology, because I know that the Edwards campaign raised some issues with the audit, and it doesn't seem to be a frontal attack on the methodology. So I understand that this is the methodology that's used with respect to obtaining matching funds and that kind of thing. It's a pretty good methodology. Folks who maybe have challenged it here and there over the years and all have failed to poke holes in it. That's a fair assessment.
That's correct, and it's also not a methodology that we developed ourselves. I mean, it's a methodology that's widely used in the auditing accounting world. In fact, the basic algebra underlying it comes out of a textbook that was published by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants some years ago. And so it is a sound methodology. Now, the committee disagrees in a lot of areas with what we consider or defined as an exception when we're evaluating the sample. Mm-hmm. That's not the same thing as challenging the technique itself.
They're dealing more with the garbage in, garbage out attack. They're not really attacking the processing of the garbage. They're saying some of the contributions in the sample are not,
or shouldn't be considered,
shouldn't be in the sample as a problematic.
At one point, they do suggest that after they're done expressing their opinion on all of the transactions that were considered exceptions, there's only three left, and that's not a valid sample. Well, the sample wasn't three. The sample was more like 650. With what they object to is only having three exceptions left in the sample. There's no minimum number of exceptions for it to be an accurate sample. As a matter of fact, this particular sampling technique is especially well suited for small error rate populations. That's its sort of specialty.
So, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thanks. I just had a question since we're right on that. So that 650 samples out of 81,000 total, say that's 8% of just calculating it out. Do you decide that in advance? Okay, we need at least 8%, we need 10%, we need 2%. Do you base it on, okay, we got 81,000 here, we can't do them all? How do you arrive at what's a representative sample?
There is a computer program that has calculations in it that at least gives you a good starting point. There are really three things that impact sample size, and as counterintuitive as it may seem, the size of the population isn't one of them. The reliability of that you want to achieve, and we all see polls that said 95% reliability will do the same thing. The sampling error that you're willing to tolerate, that's the plus or minus that we all see when a poll is published. And the one that is probably most significant is the number of exceptions that you find in the sample. So what you have to do is you start out estimating what that's going to be. You run through the initial sample, you evaluate, see how you did. If the number of exceptions was higher than you had anticipated, then you have to go back and draw more sample items in order to get the reliability and sampling error that you were aiming for. So it can be an iterative process depending on the results.
In this case, how did the percentage come about?
It was how many items we needed with the number of errors that were observed to achieve 95% reliability with the specified tolerable sampling error. And then again, the computer programs that do the algebra let us know how we how we're doing. Yeah.
Is think the Edwards Committee talks about 12 excessives in the sample, and they get down to three. I'm not being a statistician, I'm getting kind of fuzzy on where those numbers come from.
We had initially 12 exceptions. Three of them they accept. The others they argue with. So there
12
are
exceptions mean 12 excessive contributions.
In the sample.
All right. And they're saying nine are not really excessive.
That's correct.
Why do they say that?
Eric can probably do a better job on that than I can.
They actually received late signed reattribution letters, and for those, they say that although the letters were received late, the intent was there was correct, and so they reattribute them correctly. And then they also say because for the they received credit card contributions as well as check contributions. For the credit card contributions, they state that what remains from the credit card contributions that they did not receive signed reattribution letters, they say should be removed from the sample. We should remove all credit card contributions. So it gets down to the three contributions that they acknowledge are excessive.
So that the projection is just based on three contributions?
The projection is not based on three contributions. The original projection is based on the 12 contributions.
Okay. All right.
But they acknowledge there are three.
That are a problem. They agree that you have at least three found that are problems. Okay. So when you do the projection, you come up with the $239,538 number. Is that the mean? That's not the number, right? It's probably a range. When you do a projection, you're probably going to have a high number and a low number. It's probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, okay. It's the midpoint.
Okay. Any sense of what the range is? You wouldn't know, would you? So just so you know where I'm going with it, if the Edwards Committee is right that nine of the results were actually permissible contributions for whatever reason, they did a redesignation letter that was maybe not within 60 days but close enough or consistent with what we may have done in some other case, how would that affect the projection? That would probably skew it. That would move the number down significantly.
Absolutely. We would do a new projection based on whatever the number turned out to be.
Okay.
And it would certainly be lower.
It, by the way, it would also tighten the range as a result.
Right. This is why I followed up, because right, I understand. Got it.
Would it automatically just be one-fourth? Or how do you...
Not necessarily.
It would be more complicated.
Be close.
I figured that.
The high The high number is 442,000.
It's almost double the projected middle number. So the low number.
I don't think the lower bound is actually on this information that we have.
Okay.
For some reason, the program doesn't give you that.
The old program.
That's okay. Is it safe to assume that the high number versus the number in the audit report, which is the, would the low number be somewhere proportionally off of that number?
Yes, you'd hope so.
Yeah, it should be roughly symmetrical.
It would be half that.
So the plus or minus.
So half of 239 is 120. So it could be as low as 120 of excessive, even assuming it's sample, even assuming Edwards' arguments on the integrity of the sample don't carry the day, right? The 239 number could be, because it's ultimately a sample. It could be a lot less than that.
Yes.
Could be a lot less, could be a lot more.
Got it. Now, the recommendation is to pay the 239 to the U.S. Treasury, assuming that's standard kind of operating procedure.
The recommendation is actually to pay a little bit less because we gave them credit for the presumptive letters and any refund they made.
Okay. I see that's the 154 number.
Right, we're down to 154.
Got it. So that does address at least some of the arguments the Edwards campaign made with respect to some of the excessive contributions, right? You gave him, even though it wasn't within 60 days, you gave him credit and said close enough. Even if we do that, there's still $100,000+ worth of projected problems.
Right. Based on commission decisions in some other cases, the presumptive reattributions were applied as a credit. We gave them another opportunity to go through and compile that for us.
That's all I have for now. Any other thoughts on this sampling? Edwards campaign raise any other issues or any other findings? My recollection was just finding 2 and finding 4.
Basically, 2 and 4.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. Thoughts, discussion?
I would just, for just one moment, like to go back to finding 4. First time I read the report, I think, like many of the others, thought that something seemed a little bit fishy about how this transaction occurred. And then when I went back and actually looked at the regs, it didn't appear to me that the regs actually specifically prohibited what happened in this case. I think that you, if you wanted to read between the lines, or if you wanted to examine the emanations or the penumbras coming out from the regs, I think that you would say that this sort of transfer was not necessarily contemplated, and maybe was not anticipated or desired. But it, on the other hand, it's not specifically prohibited. And if it's not specifically prohibited, can we really go after the Edwards campaign for and say that they violated the law and the regulations without having, when the actual language of the regulations doesn't appear to specifically prohibit that? So this is more of a comment than a question. We've gone over this ground fairly thoroughly, but I have to agree with the chairman that troubles me as well about this finding, about whether or not we are on solid legal footing to say that this transfer was actually impermissible.
Mr. Stoltz.
I wouldn't argue that this particular transaction is not discussed in the regulation, but I think that is something that will always be the case. The commission, I don't think, has or conceivably can write a regulation to specifically cover every combination and permutation of transactions that somebody's going to come up with. I think our regulation book would be many times the size it is now, and we'd still wouldn't cover them all. You know, it was our opinion in this, and especially with respect to the debt retirement money. The regulations are fairly strict about debt retirement money, because it goes back to the basic per-election contribution limitation concept, that if you can't continue to raise money for a past election if you don't have bills to pay, because otherwise what you're really doing is raising money for another election, and in doing it, and hence doubling your contribution limitation. Clearly, the regs don't anticipate a case where somebody goes ahead and raises that retirement money, and then with the stroke of a pen, all the debt's gone. So, but I think the principles are fairly well defined. If you're raising money for debt retirement and you overshoot, which can happen if you're lucky, you have to either give it back or go back to the contributor and say, I'd like to use it for something else. And if the contributor says fine, then that's fine too. In this case, you know, they overshot because the candidate was able to make the debt disappear. But he had all this debt retirement money, which is now raised for a past election for which there is no debt. So it seemed us fairly, it was clear to us anyway, let's put it that way, it was clear to us that the intent of the regulation would be to say, okay, well, that may be fine. It's within your right to forgive the debt. It was within your right to raise money for the debt when it was there. But now that you've done both and then forgiven the debt, you either need to give the money back or go back to the contributor and say, can I use it for the presidential? And if the contributor says yes, fine, move it over. But the contribution limit for the presidential is then consumed by this. Surplus funds tend to be cases where there was more money than obligations on hand on the day of the election. I don't know if there's anywhere in the regulations where you can raise surplus campaign funds after the election. I think that's a concept that's pretty clear. So, though I certainly agree that we don't have a regulation that specifically says if you didn't raise that retirement money and then the debt disappears for whatever reason, you have to do this. The concepts embodied in regulation, I think, cover it fairly well. And that's obviously why we made a recommendation we did. And I think council agreed that the necessary concepts are there to provide guidance and to allow us to say you couldn't do this.
I tend to support that analysis because we can't just look at the fact that, okay, you have extra money and now you can do whatever you want with it, but the donor has something to say about it too. And the donor may be willing to give money to help somebody out who found themselves really going to the nth degree and needed the money, and then all of a sudden finds out that extra money that you gave, and maybe this is a donor that gave earlier, maybe it's not. Even if it's not, that may be even worse because this person probably had some pressure put on them to contribute to, because there was a debt, and then automatically it's gone, and the principal reason for that person for that campaign is no longer there. So I, and especially if the person lost, or and I'm thinking just generically, then what do you do when you to the donor's intent, which I think is always needs to be kept in mind. So for me, it's not a stretch to adopt the analysis that the audit division uses here.
The other way to look at this is one of the things we explored at the preliminary audit report is to look at this as a triangle. And one end of the triangle is the candidate, another end, the Senate committee, another end, the presidential committee. But the important thing about this triangle is that the candidate is in control of all three. Of course, he's in control of himself, he's in control of the Senate committee, and he's in control of the presidential committee. And then he can sit and eliminate a debt and move money where he could not have moved money initially himself. So I think that's important. It's just a different way to look at this.
Picking up on the vice chair's concern on contributor intent, many times people will give to a campaign and the campaign won't spend the money, it'll become excess campaign funds and then be transferred off to a party committee or something that contributors wouldn't necessarily maybe like. But that kind of oversimplifies it. I think the vice chair makes a good point, but I curious if the folks who gave to the debt retirement also gave, if we know, to the presidential campaign. Was there double dipping here? Did the folks kind of max out for the debt retirement and turn around and also write checks to the presidential campaign? Because that really gets at your kind of thing. If they didn't double dip, they could have just written the check to the presidential campaign, the whole issue, the debt issue.
We didn't really look at that part of it as part of our analysis.
Just to kind of move it along, I'm still hung up on finding four, and not sure what we can do about that at this stage. Our Commissioner Peterson also said he's hung up on finding four. The vice chair thinks it's okay. Any sense of where everyone else is on finding four? Your original concern, is that still out there? I think it would be.
Yes, but I agree with the vice chair with respect to the debt retirement. I do think the rules with respect to how you raise and spend debt retirement are pretty clear. I don't have any problem with the finding, the conclusion in the audit report with respect to that. My concern was limited to the exclusion of other monies from the definition of from the funds.
Could that retirement money ever become excess campaign funds? So when we adopt this finding, are we adopting a rule where essentially any debt retirement money is never going to end up becoming excess funds?
Mr. Chairman, I think the answer is no. The principle here is that debt retirement money, like money raised for a general election when you never participate in the general election, can't become excess campaign funds. It's if the debt no longer exists, it would then have to be returned to the contributor or duly reattributed or redesignated.
The difference, though, I think, in my mind, I think you can distinguish the difference between the situation where you don't make it to the general election, you have to give the money back, versus debt retirement money, which is a contribution limit that relates back to an election in which you did participate. So you're essentially, the law is allowing you to go back after the election and hit up those who hadn't given before the election, but they're still within that same limit. I think I kind of see it as a slightly different concept in my mind than the situation where you lose the primary and you don't never get to the general as a contribution. The other contribution that would never kick in, right? So you wouldn't have the ability to raise the extra money for a general because you're never in the general. In this case, you were in the elections. The contribution limit applies. But I understand the point. I'm not sure it's as tight a fit as it needs to be.
Yes. But debt retirement money is money that you're raising at a time when you normally would be banned from raising that money because it's after the election. Normally you can't raise money after the election. This is an exception to that rule that allows you to raise money after the election, but only for this limited purpose of retiring the debt. So if you don't have debt, you couldn't have raised the money in the first place.
Right, but when he raised the money, he had debt. This chicken and the egg, we keep going around. And then after he raised the money, then he said, we're going to forgive the debt. So there was debt at the time he raised it.
And of course, it was, he gets to decide whether he has debt or not because the debt is to him.
Right.
Which makes it even trickier.
Right, which is why this is why I'm hung up. It's very clever. I'm not so sure now we can punish cleverness after the fact when it wasn't clear such cleverness was illegal at the time. But yes, no. I thought you were gonna. No.
Okay.
Other thoughts on finding four?
My final thoughts will be that I think that the General Counsel's Office and Audit make a reasonable argument. I think that you could look at, as I think you put it, the concepts or the principles underlying these provisions, and reach the conclusion that is reached in the report. The game of finding legal loopholes and then plugging them up, and then clever lawyers finding new holes, and then I think that little song and dance has been going on as long as there's been law, probably from the time Moses brought stone tablets down from the mount. I imagine there was someone down there trying to find the loophole, and that is a maneuvering that's going to go on. It's gone on for long before we were here, and long after we were here. And so, for me personally, it comes down to what in an area where core First Amendment activities are implicated, where is the presumption going to lie? Are we going to presume that? Are we going to give these concepts a more full reading in terms of what we believe are the underlying concepts or principles, or are we going to read them narrowly according to what is actually the wording in the regs? And my approach is generally, again, since these are core First Amendment activities that are being participated in, and since it's according to my reading, I don't think that what specifically was here, even though I think that, again, I think that the underlying principles may say that this shouldn't happen. The actual language of the regs, I don't see as specifically prohibiting, and so that's where I come down on this issue.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I share the concerns articulated by the chairman and by Commissioner Peterson for many of the same reasons that they've discussed. As I said in a previous public meeting, I think it's very important for campaigns, candidates, parties, and others who participate in our political process to have a clear sense of what the rules are before they begin. And because this transaction wasn't patently prohibited, they found a clever way to sort of get around something. I think we all agree with that, but that doesn't mean that it's patently impermissible. And also, as is stated in the audit report, One of my other concerns is as stated here, the commission may initiate an enforcement action at a later time with respect to any of the matters discussed in this report. Of course, enforcement actions are not public, and I don't want to speak to anything that's not on the public record, but my understanding is if we find that this transfer was not appropriate, that may then appear in a different context, and I think approving that finding could come up again in the future, possibly. Thank you.
Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Somebody's looking for loopholes in the First Amendment. They're going to have to answer to a higher authority than us. And the penalties will probably be commensurately more severe than anything we could impose. It's not really a revolutionary notion that one would read regulations in light of the intent behind them and behind the statute. I think that Mr. Stoltz made a good point. We couldn't possibly write our the regulations are fat enough as they are. It's already a pretty hefty book. We couldn't possibly write to prevent every conceivable clever way around the rules that somebody might think of down the road. And I just don't have a problem with looking at the regs and there's a longstanding principle in the law that this commission has approved on various occasions that you don't let people do something indirectly that they couldn't do directly. Seems to me if we reject the finding on the debt retirement, that's pretty much where we're going. But I'm comfortable with the debt retirement conclusion of the audit report as is. It doesn't look like there will be 4 votes for it, but just wanted to make my views known.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chair.
I wonder if maybe to get the ball off, I'll move approval of the audit report, and then I know some or all will be carved away, but I think probably now we've all had a say and we can see what we can come up with.
Okay, so motion is to adopt the final audit report. All in favor say aye.
I'll say aye. I assume to be an amendment to it, but
I thought the intent was just to see, just take the audit report as is, vote on that first. And sorry, I missed
it. Either way it works. Then somebody's going to have to make another motion, so.
Oh, okay.
However.
Got it.
If it's going to be,
instead of doing a series of motions.
No compromise, then we might as well just get it on now.
I'd like to move that we adopt the audit report with one slight modification to the inclusion of all funds not limited to the contributions, as I've previously explained.
That's a substitute motion.
Yes, I apologize. That's a substitute motion.
Okay. Does that affect the numbers in the audit report?
Yes, it does. It would lower the amount by around $69,000 for the first transfer.
Okay. So I assume the motion would include also adjusting the numbers accordingly.
Yes.
Right. So procedurally, it would be an amended to substitute entirely, and I would accept that as a friendly amendment. I think that's the way we are, unless you vote the first one down.
I think you can make, I'll defer to council, but I think that a commissioner can make a substitute motion.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yep, in Directive 10. A whole paragraph on this. So on the substitute motion, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No.
Okay, that deadlocks 3-3. So now we could have another motion, maybe, without finding four. We do one finding at a time, or you know, whatever you think moves it along.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I would like to move for the adoption of the Edwards Audit Report Agenda Document Number 08-34, subject to removing the finding four.
Okay, so the motion is to adopt the audit report without finding four. All in favor, say aye.
Mr. Chairman, if
yes.
I might.
Go ahead.
What the commission tradition does with audit findings that aren't approved is they remain, and there's an explanation of the commission's action on them, and it helps lay out for the regulated community a little better what the commission's interpretations of these issues are. So what would happen is finding four would be revised to explain that the commission was unable to reach a conclusion on the issue.
We would first need to have a vote on that, the right?
We would, okay. But I thought your motion said to remove finding
okay.
four.
Okay, then I would modify my motion to, how has that been done in the past, if I might inquire? Is it to disapprove? Approve of the report with the exception of finding four, or how should I properly couch this motion?
It's actually, I think it's been done a number of ways in the past, and Mr. Stoltz and Mr. Holloway can help me out here, but I believe there have been instances where the commission has voted to approve the other findings and to receive the finding that didn't get majority support, which sort of indicates that there was less than total agreement with that finding. There have been instances where the report has been returned to the audit division for the addition of further language on the finding to explain the commission's action, whether it was a majority action or a split. There have been instances where the report has been held over and commissioners themselves have come up with language to that effect where each side explained their particular action. I don't think that's happened very often, but I believe it happened in the Bush and Kerry audit reports, and there may be some other options that I'm not thinking about.
So Commissioner Peterson's motion, as is though, is something that's consistent with what's happened before here and there. There's different ways of doing this. We could strike the finding completely. We could do this accept it, which is a rather new, within the past 10 years, new approach where the finding stays, but then it notes that the commission was unable to adopt it. Concern I have with that approach is, at the end of the day, the distinction between whether it's the audit division's report or the commission's report, I think gets lost outside of the building. After all, it's on, you know, it's on the commission letterhead. So I think when you accept the finding, I don't think anyone really, I my sense is that that's not quite the distinction that Commissioner Peterson is looking for, because I think it still looks like it's part of the audit report, but I'll let him speak for himself on the point.
Would it be more appropriate to couch the motion as approving particular findings, approving 1, 2, 3 and 5 without saying that we are removing finding 4, and then if
with the understanding that we would revise finding 4 to reflect that the commission was unable to reach agreement on the issues presented therein.
So that would work, assuming that's the way the vote goes.
Okay. Then
can I ask a question about that? What's the significance of keeping finding 4 in there if there's not sufficient votes to adopt it?
It is the way the commission has operated these past 30 years, so that the report as presented, it becomes part of the record, and the commission's decisions with respect to those findings are reflected on the public record. It does provide the regulated community guidance in the future. If it just disappears, then you know, the people in this room know, and anybody who happens to see the agenda item knows, but anybody reading the report later wouldn't even realize that the issue was raised or what the resolution was.
But am I correct? I mean, obviously the report that we're talking about right now is a public document.
It is.
Okay.
It is. It will be an agenda document. The official report that is released, placed on the commission's website as the audit report, would not be this version. It would be the amended version.
But the public would have access to this document, obviously, because it is a public document. So if one were interested, they could go back and I'm not sure if it's the interim report. I'm not sure if the interim report is public. I think it's
not. It is not.
Okay, so they would see this report presented by the audit division, then the one that was adopted by the commission in the public meeting. Correct?
It would. If the finding just disappears, then anybody looking at our website and reading an audit report to see what the issues were is not going to know to go look for an old agenda item. However, if the finding stays and the resolution of the finding is presented, whether the commission adopts it or they don't adopt it, then that information is out there in the place where people would tend to look for it.
And so the purpose of that is so the public knows that the audit division found this, but the commission didn't agree with it.
Yes.
Is that the
And
purpose?
That provides guidance for people in the future.
Can I, why does that? Maybe I can take a stab at this. Of course, we wrestled with this, obviously, before. And what the commission decided before in similar situations where there was a 3-3 split was that if you just take it out, then if somebody was looking for, you know, what does the commission think on the issue of debt retirement, they wouldn't find it. You know, it just would be gone, missing. I mean, yes, if somebody was very industrious, they might say, well, gee, maybe what the final report was wasn't the whole story, and I could go back and look through all the agenda documents, but and the chairman probably would have done that, but a lot of folks out in private practice might not be quite that industrious. So what the commission decided in the past would be more helpful to the regulated community would be to show them that, in fact, this issue was raised, it was discussed, and there was not support on the commission to adopt the recommendation that the auditors made. And that provides more guidance than people sitting out there scratching their heads saying, gee, I wonder if this issue's ever come up before.
That makes a lot of sense, that the fact that it was raised and when the commission took some action on the issue, and I think that's good for public notice. The concern I have, though, is could someone then take this and later say that the FEC auditors found that Senator Edwards, you know, transferred illegal money and split the difference? That's always been my concern, is that someone takes the paragraph and then runs out and says, well, the FEC auditor, and they just completely blur the legal distinction to whether or not we adopted it. It's a true statement that the FEC auditors, you know, made a finding, but it doesn't really, it's not really a fair characterization of what we do, but it ends up being done. I mean, I'm thinking someone runs a, you know, an issue ad someday and says, you know, they found, it's a true statement that there was a, you know, the auditors found something.
I think we can probably, in the amended audit report, draft around that issue. I'm looking to Mr. Stoltz for, you know, if it's drafted carefully, I think we can get around that problem.
That's my concern.
We've done that in the past.
Okay.
I would actually think that the concern you're raising would be more problematic because this is an agenda document and it is out there. And then if the final report says nothing, then there's nothing for someone to refute that. The final audit report is the conclusion of the commission. If it says the commission couldn't reach a result on that, it seems to me that's much more useful for someone trying to refute an attempt to manipulate what the agenda document says, because that's out there already. That's a public document. There's no pulling this back. So if the final audit report needs to be amended to state whatever the state of this consensus or lack of consensus is, it can do that. But it seems to me that's far better evidence for someone worrying about an ad about an audit finding.
Don't we have any more AOs? I mean, we were doing better on the AO.
There's a couple more. They're not quite ready to go. I think they'll be good. We can do this.
All right.
A Libertarian Party wants to be recognized, that kind of stuff. We're good at those.
Yeah, we can agree on that.
I think one of the things we went through before, and I remember the debate back and forth on that, was a concern on the part of some of the commissioners, and not all, that the audit is an independent function, and that at least the position of the auditors could be known, and it wouldn't be buried because of commission action in some hard-to-find place, but that at least the matter in the auditors being independent would be become known, and the position taken by the commission would become known for better or for worse, and at least that independent role would be recognized.
As one of the things that
I think was an argument that we made before on another matter that was hotly debated in the first term here.
It adds to the transparency, too, of the commission's operation.
That makes sense. I agree the auditors do have their own division, but they still are Federal Election Commission auditors. They're no longer over GAO. You know, they are. So it's not like we have a separate entity doing an audit. I mean, it's still our audit. I still have the concern, though, that people twist these down the road into strange directions where they make much of an audit finding, even if it was rejected. But I think Commissioner Weintraub is probably on the money, that we could probably write it in a way that pads that up a little bit and makes it clear that this isn't the commission. Did not get a support of the commission in some form, is it four votes or however we phrase it, but something that would address the concern, I think.
Okay. Then with respect to agenda document number 08-34, I would move that we approve findings 1, 2, 3, and 5.
Now, if I understand the consensus, if I understand the consensus, though, this would stay in and our position would become known with that motion in effect. If I understand to be the case.
I take it that comments. Would be your intent.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
And there would be revisions to the report to reflect.
There would be revisions in, yes. Right. There would be revisions in the final audit report to reflect where the commission stood with respect to this finding.
Mr. Chairman, I guess this really probably is the audit division will do the revisions. It'll be more Ms. Thomas's concern than ours. But I'm not entirely clear without a vote. If there's no vote on finding for whether the commission is by this motion not accepting finding four or whether it is going to split on finding four.
If we had a separate vote on finding four,
then there would be something to, there'd be a way to characterize.
As I recall, in the previous situation we were confronted with, was the same thing arose, and we did have an understanding that the votes would be incorporated into the actually audit. There were three commissioners voted this way, three commissioners voted that way.
And it's whether it's the 3-3 or something else that I guess that I'm trying to.
Well, we've already had one vote. Right. Doesn't that sort of clarify where we are on the whole thing with finding four?
I suppose in my mind not entirely, because the first vote was, as I understood, the first vote was on a motion to accept finding four with the change to reflect the funds issued to Commissioner Bowerly.
But didn't that include the debt retirement analysis of the audit division?
That's what I was trying to nail down. If that does, that's fine.
I think it did. Try it again.
I think there's a motion.
Okay. me what the motion on the table is? On findings 1, 2, 3, and 5?
Yes.
To adopt those? Okay, that's the motion.
And to revise the final report to reflect the discussion at the table?
Correct.
Okay. On,
apologize. With the reference to which commissioners took which position on 4?
I
don't see a nod on that or not.
We've done it a number of ways.
If you want it that
years.
Way, we can certainly have it that way.
Yeah, I mean, if you want it that way, you can have it that way. So it's sort of a subset of yeah. Commissioner Weintraub's, you know, just consistent with the discussion at the table.
I think that would be consistent with the discussion at the table.
That'll mean whatever we want it to mean once we after we vote on this, right? That's a nice way of saying we'll figure that out later, right? That's like a commission code for we'll get to that. All right, I'm learning.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, just for the record, maybe the thing to do, if we're not in agreement now, is to understand that, for example, if I wanted to approve 4, subsequent motion could be made, could be modified, we could agree to it, and there'd be a record on that regard, I suppose.
That would
procedurally
work as well.
There's a way to find some clarity here.
That would work as well.
Okay. But are we not agreeing now to just do it the way was originally brought up, and that is just mentioned that the three commissioners voted this way on 4 or not. What do you recommend? Because it's not a pure 4, we agreed on a modified 4.
It would, I think I see your point that if the motion is, it would probably, the clearest thing would be if the motion was to approve findings 1, 2, 3, and 5, which Commissioner Peterson said, and to revise finding 4 pursuant to the table discussion and to reflect the previous vote on Commissioner Ballard's motion.
Is it? I believe that's consistent. I think
so,
that's the motion I made.
Now
so
I'm going to throw a curve. on finding 2.
Oh, no.
Well, finding 2 is as a result the revised payment owed to the U.S. Treasury of $154,078. But that's the statistical kind of projection. We understand we're voting that now the commission's deciding that they owe that much money to the U.S. Treasury. What's the significance of that sentence? We decide the whole shooting match on that issue by adopting this finding, because it the first part of the finding is fine, because it talks about projection and the audit staff recommended that they do this, and I can understand that's how we do things. But then as a result the revised payment owed to the U.S. Treasury is $154,000, which is still a projection as I understand it, right?
It is a projection, and it is consistent with what we have done with these findings in the past.
Inconsistent with the regulation.
I think probably most recent example was the Gephardt for President.
Yes.
So once we adopt this, they're going to owe $154,000 to the U.S. Treasury?
Yes.
As a disgorgement payment. Okay. All right, so the motion's on, same motion. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion passes. 6-0. Right. No nays.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I just need some guidance on procedure now. We adopt some new language for finding number 4. Would you like us to recirculate this?
Probably recirculate.
Or, yes?
Some form. Take a 10-minute recess. Next up is a report of the Audit Division on Sharpton 2004.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm Rhonda Gellingwater.
Maybe pull back towards you some, because it's picking up the other, you're getting a loop there. There you go.
Okay. I'm Rhonda Gellingwater. I am going to present the report of the Audit Division on Sharpton 2004, the Principal Campaign Committee for Reverend Alfred C. Sharpton, candidate for the Democratic Party's nomination for the office of president. We have five findings. Finding number one, net outstanding campaign obligations. As of March 15, 2004, Sharpton 2004 was in a deficit position of $1,426,661. Finding number two, candidate personal spending limit. The audit staff's analysis indicated that the candidate exceeded his personal spending limit by $446,426. Finding number three, receipt of prohibited contributions. Our analysis indicates that Sharpton 2004 has received a minimum of $486,803 in prohibited funds. And at this point, we have a change in language that we may be adding that will be inserted on page 17, the last paragraph, sentence, it will come after sentence five. It will start with, however, it appears that any limited voter registration activity undertaken by the Archer Group was coordinated with the Sharpton 2004 campaign. The Archer Group reports that it was retained for the work performed at NAND's expense by the Sharpton 2004 campaign manager, who had no role or position with NAND. The NAND executive director, who was responsible for NAND's voter registration effort, stated that she had no role in retaining or managing the Archer Group effort and that its work was not part of NAND's overall registration effort. Further, the Archer Group reports that it actually did very little voter registration work during the time it was being paid by NAND. The Archer Group focused its efforts on the scheduling and advanced logistics services for Sharpton in his role as a candidate. Approximately 1 month after being retained, its work was placed under the formal control of Sharpton 2004 campaign manager. The Archer Group reports that there was little change in the nature of its responsibilities being performed when its billing arrangements moved from NAND to Sharpton 2004. Given the statements made by the Archer Group, the Sharpton 2004 campaign manager, and the NAND executive director, as well as the lack of records to contradict their accounts, it appears that the Archer Group services paid for by NAND were coordinated with and were for the benefit of Sharpton 2004. Finding four, receipt of excessive contributions. The campaign received a total of $10,500 from six individuals. And finding number five, misstatement of financial activity. I'm available for questions.
Look over, and there you are, smiling. No, just before we move to a vote, I appreciate the effort to drop in this language. And I apologize to everyone. I kind of have, my cold has gotten worse up here, so I'm moving even slower than I usually do. I appreciate everyone's indulgence. When I first read the audit, it seemed to me that NAND, the 501c4, could, in theory, do some activity. I didn't want to have an audit report say that it was create some new potentially something someone may read someday and say that, that somehow there was some new rule created or something. And I appreciate this language because I think it makes it clear, so it addresses that concern. Given that it's an open meeting, just a general question. I understand that Sharpton Treasurer has sent us quite a bit of correspondence and raised some issues. Anything specifically raised in there we need to know, and to the extent there is, do you have a response?
There were several letters. I think probably the second letter is a little shorter, probably a little bit easier to respond to. He does mention, well, we've talked about the voter registration. He does talk about the Amex. There are a couple things I would like to point out. He talks about there being personal activity on that account. And we went to great lengths to pull the personal activity off of that account. His wife's activity, for example, was pulled off of there. And anything that we felt was not campaign activity, we did pull off. We went to great lengths to research using the internet anything that we could find to pull that activity off of there. He talks about the payments, any payments that did not clear, and there were a lot of payments that went onto the account that we that did not clear. Those were taken off. We also used ratios based on non-presidential activity and personal activity, and we prorated the payments that were made on the account, and those were pulled away from any possible prohibited activity. So that we feel has been answered. We felt that was fairly done. In terms of the activity that was left over on the account, the more than $300,000, we are not making any comments about that activity, whether or not it's prohibited. It hasn't been paid. We feel like we've dealt with that because that any activity that's left in that aspect is we would be considering that as being on his debt schedule. So we're not going to make comments as to whether or not it's prohibited. As to how he pays that, I'm not sure if he pays it. Joe, maybe you might.
Seems to be the treasurer's concern. That seems to be the theme, is assume there's a problem, who's going to hold the bag?
Normally, the campaign would raise funds to pay that off.
If the candidate pays it, then I think we have additional problems with, you know, the personal spending limit, which is already there. The campaign pays it, that's great if they had the funds. If any of the related organizations paid it, I think it would worsen the problem with prohibited funds. But as Rhonda said, right now nobody's paid it. So it's sort of neutral.
Is this an issue we need to decide before adopting the final audit report?
I don't believe so.
No, I don't think so. Normally it would be on the any campaign would have any leftover debt would be on their debt schedule, and they would try to raise funds. That's something that any campaign would try to do. There are a couple of other things they point out. They do mention a birthday party, $11,000, to be fair. At the time, we had no knowledge. They do mention another birthday party. They never made any mention to us of a second birthday party. The birthday party that we had information on was a fundraiser, a presidential fundraiser, at a 40/40 club held by Jay-Z. Puff P. Diddy attended, and Russell Simmons. And we had no information, nor did they provide any information for any other birthday party. We certainly would have been open to that. Had they provided information.
You weren't invited?
I wasn't invited. I certainly would
have. Sounds like a good party.
Probably would not have been allowed to attend, but I might have enjoyed that. That would have been fun, sure. It would have been great. We're certainly always open if they will provide information on that. So this is the first we have heard of it. Might have been, I don't know. When we did see Nan paying money for musicians for a birthday party. I'm just responding to things that he said in there. and then some campaign travel in South Carolina. But the executive director did tell us that she did travel to South Carolina for presidential activity. And then I think the last thing they did respond to, and to make comments to, was $39,000 in loans. But at this point, there are not $39,000 in loans. There is only $15,000 remaining, of which we have absolutely no idea where the source of the funds are, and that is why that amount is still remaining. So we have just no idea where the money came from. So.
So the bottom line is the issues raised by the treasurer you've considered.
Mm-hmm.
They reflected the final report that we've adopted. We can feel good that he hasn't raised issues that we were not going to consider and that kind of thing. He's been heard.
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. I think so.
That's all I have. So, motion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we adopt agenda document number 08-39 with the changes suggested at the table by the audit staff.
Sufficiently clear. Did we get that? All in favor?
Say aye. Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, did Commissioner Peterson say 08-30?
I'll check. Thanks, Larry, for
38.
Making sure we get the right document. What did you say? 0838?
0838.
Right. As amended by the additional language, right? That's the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion passes 6-0. Thank you. We're going to move to the, that's 4 o'clock now. I understand some folks had some other scheduling obligations at 4. We were talked about moving to the Cool for Congress audit report. I'm recused. I'll turn over the gavel to the vice chair if we do that. But given that it's 4, do we want to do that now? Or do we want to? Yes? Do it now? Okay. I'm going to excuse myself and turn over the gavel to the. Yeah. Right. You can gavel it out. I can just. Right.
It shows that the chairman and his assistants have left the room and will take up agenda document 0836 this time.
Chairman, could I have a moment to gather staff?
Sure. Jumping the gun on you a little bit here. I'm advised that I should make a record right now that we're going to skip over an item on the agenda. I was going to wait till later to do that, but The Missouri Democratic State Committee matter, agenda document 0836, as I understand it, we'll put that off to our next executive session, or our next meeting, and we'll go right now to Cool for Congress, which is 0835. And Mr. Peterson, do you have a motion to make?
Were you planning on giving a brief summary at the outset, or don't want to step on your
okay.
On your intro?
He already introduced it, but I'll go ahead and you guys know me from earlier, obviously. The report of the Audit Division on the Cool for Congress Committee, 2004 Principal Campaign Committee for Congressman Randy Cool, candidate for Congress from New York's 29th District. The audit resulted in the following findings: misstatement of financial activity and receipt of prohibited in-kind contributions. Any questions? We'll talk about them.
Thank you. In this matter, it appears that most of the findings revolve around a period of time when then State Senator Randy Kuhl was running for state office, and he also filed with the FEC to be a federal candidate, but had not publicly announced his candidacy. And his counsel explains the reason for that is he was waiting to determine whether or not the sitting member of Congress at the time, Amo Houghton, would run for re-election or not. So for the period of approximately a year, he had filed his candidacy with the FEC, but he wasn't publicly seeking office. And the reason why that's relevant is many of the findings revolve around that time period where the candidate raised approximately $84,000 and had $12,000 of expenditures in order to raise that amount. And that $12,000 was filed with the FEC. And he, at that same time, had an office that was paid, that all the overhead expenses were paid out of the state account. And the auditors have looked at that and said, well, someone must have been sitting somewhere in order to raise that $84,000. And so because the counsel for Kuhl didn't give an allocation formula, instead, again, the candidate simply reported the expenditures that, in their view, were made for federal purposes. The auditors then came up with an allocation formula based on the amount of money that the campaign raised, and used that allocation formula to then go back and allocate the overhead expenditures for that period in time that were used for the state committee according to the campaign. So I look at the file and read all of the background and the filings and everything, and I think it's perfectly reasonable that a candidate would not necessarily have somebody who was raising that federal money in the state campaign. It's perfectly conceivable to me that, again, they only raised $84,000 and spent $12,000 doing so. It's perfectly conceivable that somebody could have done that as a volunteer. Somebody could have done that, you know, it could have been a state employee who was doing it on their own time. It could have been the congressman himself. If the point is to report the expenditures that were made by the federal campaign and then also the state campaign, in my view, the campaigns both did that. And there's nothing in the regs that they didn't follow. And I believe that in this case, the auditors have come up with something. And I understand the reasoning. We had very helpful conversations with the auditors and OGC on this matter in advance of this meeting. But I am not prepared to approve a finding today that the committee received any prohibited in-kind contributions, which is directly the finding of finding two, and that is interrelated with the finding of, with the audit finding number one. One other point is that following the time that the candidate announced his candidacy for federal office, almost all the expenditures for that same office were paid by the federal campaign. So that's the way that the campaign decided to run itself. Once it was clear to them they were going to become a federal candidate, they paid for all those expenditures with the federal funds. And then after he won election, they split it up according to them, to the way that they spent the funds. So what I propose that we do in order to potentially solve this matter today is ask the audit staff to circulate an amended report that reflects, to the extent that the audit division has evidence that the campaign should have paid for something with federal funds, present that to us, and then in that case, I'd be more than willing to approve that kind of finding. But in the absence of a specific finding that they didn't use federal funds for an expenditure that they should have, I'm not prepared to accept today. Thank you.
Any further comments from commissioners or from the other divisions? Excuse me,
I just have a couple brief comments. First of all, let me thank Mr. Faven, Ms. Lee, Ms. Painter for meeting with us at length this morning to go over this matter and discuss things, answer questions. I felt that was very productive and was very much appreciated. And I think that helped us understand and get a more full picture of what was happening here. I agree with what Commissioner Hunter had to say. I'm I'm not comfortable with the allocation method that was used in this audit report. And to their credit, audit staff recognized that this was a kind of a tough situation, and were fully candid with us both in our meeting and in the report itself about the limitations of this method of allocation. And they were put in a bit of a difficult spot. As I read the regs and also even looking at relevant advisory opinions, the test for the proper allocation in this sort of situation appears to be a test that looks at the actual benefit that is derived by each committee. And using the method that was used in this instance, the looking at the fundraising receipts by each committee during that relevant period between March 03 and March 04, I do not believe is supported in either the in either the law or in the regulations. And I don't even think it's very much reflective of the facts. The allocation ended up being heavily weighted towards these expenditures being paid primarily with federal funds, when the facts as I read them didn't seem to justify a disproportionate allocation towards federal dollars. So having said that, I'm not able to support this finding, but I would be open to the suggestion that Commissioner Hunter presented, that we ask the audit staff to revise its report, looking at using the standard of the actual benefit derived by the federal committee versus the actual benefit derived by the state committee, providing the underlying factual support for those findings, and then recirculating that that report. And so I would support that measure as well.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Are there any other comments, or would the audit division like to comment on that suggestion? Yes.
Well, of course, in a number of these cases, we feel that we have looked at, you know, where the documentation is sufficient to establish who was benefiting, and done those allocations as best we could. The information available here is sparse with respect to a lot of this activity during this period of time. For those that we couldn't, we did choose what we felt was the only available allocator, which may not be the perfect one, but the only one that that was available, and that being the money they were raising. Given the fact that you know, it was the year before the election for the most part, fundraising seemed to be what they were doing most of, other than the overhead expenses. And because of that, it also helps with using relative fundraising a little for the expenses that they were incurring during that period of time. We can, if the commission wants, be more specific or more detailed in this analysis. That we can certainly do. You know, we feel that the information presented, the recommendation presented, is a fair resolution to the problem. And I understand that during that year, Congressman Kuhl hadn't publicly announced his candidacy, but that's really not, under FDCA, that's not the test. He had filed a statement of candidacy. He had raised 80-some-odd thousand dollars and spent 12 of that out of a federal committee, so I think he was a candidate at that point. It is also entirely possible that while there was paid staff and campaign headquarters for the non-federal, that the federal was somehow run by a volunteer and there were no expenses associated with it. Doesn't seem particularly likely to us, and it's nothing that the committee has proffered as the explanation. And so we presumed, since they appear to be running out of the same office, that there should be a sharing of the overhead expenses that go with it, as well as some of the other expenses of the campaign, some of the polling and that sort of thing that was going on.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Just a couple of questions. You said the records were sparse.
We obviously had information on the payments the federal account made, and we had the state committee's reports, but and Erica can fill in better than I on the details of that.
Were there records that they were supposed to be maintaining that they weren't, or did they say there was just nothing to maintain records about?
Well, since the state paid these expenses, these would have been state records. So we asked for records to support that payments that were made 100% by the state. Mm-hmm. We asked for documentation to support those. For some, they were able to supply them and we were able to make the appropriate adjustments. But for those that they could not, we used the funds received method during that 2000 to 2004 period.
And with respect to the money that they raised, I mean, it seems like what I'm hearing is they raised, what, $84,000 during this period of time when they were sort of trying to operate a little bit below the radar screen, so as, you know, perhaps not to alienate Congressman Houghton before he made his decision as to whether he's going to run again. And you're assuming that he was raising that money operating out of this state office because he didn't have a federal office, but it seems like this is a factual question that could be resolved. Did we ask him, how'd you raise the money?
Well, yes, we did talk to them about it, and we didn't really get much in documentation to support any answer for that.
Oral explanation, anything? I mean, how? It seems like this is a question that would be easy to answer. You know, how did you raise this money?
They did pay a fundraising firm, $12,000. That's what the $12,000 was paid for.
And they say that was the entire explanation for the.
Basically,
all of the money was raised by the fundraising firm.
The money they paid to the fundraising firm was the money spent on behalf of raising those contributions.
And like you say, they were waiting for the congressman to decide whether he was going to run again, and he was kind of in, you know, waiting for that decision for almost a year.
So he didn't have an official campaign office. He wasn't advertising a phone number or anything like that.
Correct.
Well, I mean, personally, I don't have a problem with the audit report as is. Obviously, if there aren't four votes to adopt this audit report, then we can send it back and see if we can get an audit report that there will be four votes for. That's okay.
Any other comment? From my own view, I am with Commissioner Weintraub on this, but I have no problem with the methodology used, but I can count. So I think certainly this may be a way to find a way to get to a different result. But I'm wondering, when you were looking at all the state expenditures, as I understand it, did you just call out the ones that you couldn't identify and then apply the ratio to it? Is that how it worked? Or did you add the unidentified ones in a ratio with the others, and did that change the ultimate proration?
We went to the state reports first, and from the state reports we determined which expenditures we viewed might be shared expenditures. We then asked the committee to submit documentation. We gave them a schedule, and they were able to submit documentation for some of the expenditures, and for those they did, we made the appropriate adjustments, whether it was, you know, letting it be, adjusting it back to 100% state, or allocating it based on the documentation between state and federal. For those that we did not have any documentation for, depending on when the expenditure was made, if it was made between 2003 and the first quarter of 2004, we used the funds received method. If it was made after the election, depending on the expenditure, we used their allocation with employees. They had allocated a couple of their employees on in November reports. So we used what their allocator after the election, and then on other expenditures, we viewed 100% after the reports, based on the expenditure.
I'm not fully clear on exactly when you implemented the various different approaches, but what, just roughly out of curiosity, what roughly of the expenditures, what percent were not identified or were
If we're not documented?
They're not documented. Now, I gather that there's a difference between not documented and ones that, from what you know, you suspect to be shared expenses. Just because they were documented, do you presume they were shared?
If the documentation indicated that they were shared, then we allocated it based on that documentation. If the documentation indicated it was 100% federal, there was certain expenditures that we originally, 100% state, then we adjusted it back to 100% mm-hmm. state. If we did not have documentation for expenditures, then we either did it on the funds received method for the beginning, the 2003 through 2004, or we did it on their method, on their allocation method after the election, or we did it based on some expenditures we viewed 100% after the election based on the expenditure.
Okay. Commissioner Hatter.
I think, Mr. Vice Chair, your line of questioning brings up something that we talked about earlier this morning, which is one of the concerns for us on this issue is the burden of proof. And it seems as if when the campaign said, well, that was purely a state expense, we didn't take them at their word, and we said, oh, but it doesn't seem like it was, and if you can't prove that the people in the state office were in fact doing activities for your state reelection, he was up for state reelection, then we imposed this formula. And so that's a whole nother issue, which I think is very important, but in my view, we shouldn't shift the burden onto the candidate when we're just not happy with the answer that it was a state expenditure.
Further comment? Yes, Commissioner Weintraub.
I'd just like to ask counsel to comment on the burden of proof issue, if you could.
Traditionally, we viewed the burden of proof burden of production in an audit context as being different from the burden of production and the burden of proof in an enforcement context. In an enforcement matter, we, the government, are saying that somebody violated, if we're going all the way with it, somebody violated the law to the point where they should pay a penalty. And we've always viewed the statute as requiring us to prove to a standard of probable cause in the enforcement context. That the violation was committed. In the audit context, where although referrals are in some cases possible, it's kind of a different kettle of fish. We are merely trying to determine, pursuant to our audit program under 438B, trying to verify the committee's compliance and the committee's reports. And as with anybody who's audited by the IRS or an IG or whomever, in any sort of audit situation, auditors will come in and say, okay, document to us, give us the records by which you can document that you have complied with the law. And if they can give us records that say that provide that documentation and permit us to verify their compliance and verify the statements that they have made in their reports, that's fine. And if they can't provide that documentation, then what do we do? And you really have, it seems to me, I think about two choices there. You can either say, well, for purposes of the audit, we're going to say that the burden of production of documents.
You pulled their state reports and started fishing through their state reports and said, are you sure that was really a state expenditure? So it's not really, I don't think what you said directly fits toward that. Talking about the federal reports, I guess we looked through them and said, gee, there's no office expenses here. How could you raise 84 grand without an office? So instead, I guess my point is we didn't look at one of the expenditures on here and say, well, that's really inappropriate or looks like you spent money where it wasn't appropriate. We instead looked and said, wow, you don't have an office.
Well, with respect to the record keeping requirement, I just say that in 104.14, there's a requirement that you keep sufficient records by which we can verify the statements that you make or by extension omit from your reports. And in 109.2, there's a requirement that you keep sufficient records of contributions to or disbursements by your committee. one of the things, and the auditors can talk to, can speak to this better than I can, but we're at some point, if a committee, and I know this is the case in requests for additional information, if a committee shows no overhead expenses whatsoever, we'll ask the committee, well, where are your overhead expenses? And again, you all can talk to this better than I can in this particular instance, but I think they've had a fairly ample opportunity to answer that question and really haven't.
Just to be clear, the record keeping requirements that you cited to, those are for federal committees, right? We don't have jurisdiction over state committees.
They are for federal committees. On the other hand, there is a prohibition on the authorized committee where a candidate has a state committee and a federal committee. There is a regulatory prohibition on the state committee providing financial support to the federal committee. So if there's a question raised as to whether in fact the state committee did provide financial support to the federal committee, but the reports don't show, and the reports raise that question but don't resolve the issue, then it seems to me appropriate in an audit to ask for the information of the records that would resolve that issue.
Is there any further comment on any end? Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say that on audits, auditors often go to whatever information is necessary to help to verify the accuracy of the reports. And it's not always because we're trying to, sometimes what we find doesn't necessarily prove that there's a violation. It also proves that there's not one, too. And so going to state records if they're available or to state reports that are on public disclosure is something that we routinely do.
I would just say that I have no problem with referencing state records, but it does concern me when we draw a negative inference if state records, which are not required to be maintained under federal regulation because they're outside of our jurisdiction, if the fact that they can't produce those, that we draw a negative inference saying, well, then that must have been, unless you can prove some sort of prove otherwise, we're going to assume that those were funds that either needed to be paid with all federal dollars or at least an allocated portion. That's one of the issues. And that's something that we discussed at length in our meeting today. So that's something I think going forward is something we may also want to consider.
Okay, anything further? If not, then is there a motion?
I would move that we instruct, I guess first of all inquire with counsel about making sure that I'm presuming that if I just make a motion to instruct audit staff to revise the report consistent with the discussion at the table to apply an actual benefit derived test as opposed to using this allocation. Is there anything more or less specific that I need to relate than that?
Well, I defer that question to Mr. Stoltz and Ms. Thomas as to whether they could actually make it happen or not.
I gather then what the motion is, it would be to include in expenses benefiting the federal committee paid by the non-federal, only those for which we have some documentation that shows, and that the commission would disapprove an allocation of expenses where the proper allocation, if any, can't be determined from the available records.
See if I correct for me, I didn't interpret the motion to be that way. I think, as I understood it, the motion would be to go back and come back to us with that information, and we could debate the issue later as to how we want to allocate that. I would want to agree, particularly today, that we'd be bound by that. That I'm interested in to know that, to help resolve this. But I understand it to mean that we'll automatically accept that as the final decision that we couldn't consider a modification of that or something along that line.
I think Mr. Siltz accurately reflects what we were thinking, but that it would come around on a tally vote. Is that
Well, it would, but that would also mean that we have a decision that we're not going to do an allocation mm-hmm. in this
That's
case.
Right. Yeah.
And again, going back to some of the things we just did with the Edwards report, the way that would normally be done is the allocation presented, and then there would be an explanation that the commission determined that the certain, particularly the overhead, because that's where most of it is, would not require an allocation in this situation.
Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. I was under the impression walking in here that we were just going to send this back to audit to see if they could come up with more documentation that you would find more satisfactory. I was not under the impression that we were making any legal conclusions here today as to what the appropriate standard would be, because I, you know, the ratio according to the benefit reasonably expected to be derived is a long-standing principle in FEC world and in FEC law and regulations, and I'm not aware of a regulation that says that you can only allocate based on actual benefit. That it sounds like you're going to a place that I'm not aware of there being support in the regulations for. It's like a higher threshold than we have used in the past, and that we have in our regulation. So I'm not comfortable voting here to say, oh yeah, I support that. What I'm prepared to support is sending it back to audit to see if they can come up with more data or something that would, you know, that it would ultimately come back for another vote, and maybe the legal determination would be met there. But you know, if we were going to be asked to make a change in our legal standard here at the table, I wouldn't want to do that without some further thought on that. I'm not prepared to do that right now.
I don't know that I characterize it as a change in our legal theory, although I'm not sure, because I just don't have enough of a frame of reference to know whether this would be a major departure or not. But I think in this case, what we're trying to say is, and I think Joe said it best so far, is that, or Mr. Stoltz, sorry.
I like
can
Joe.
Call you Joe?
Okay. Just plain Joe. Just Joe the auditor.
Is that we don't think that it's appropriate to have an allocation formula in this case at all. In this case. Now, of course, there's regs on the books, and there's other circumstances where it is appropriate. But in this case, there is no reg on point. And as mentioned by Commissioner Peterson and in the actual document, the audit came up with this allocation formula, and by their own admission, it maybe wasn't as clean as it could have been, but in their view, it was the best way to move forward. So I don't think it's fair to say that this is required by the regulations, and I think they even acknowledge that, and please correct me if I'm misstating that. But so I think our view is send this back and don't characterize any of these expenses as prohibited in-kind contributions. Furthermore, don't use the allocation formula in this case. But to the extent that we have evidence that the federal committee benefited in any way by the state expenditure, show us that evidence, and we're perfectly willing to say you should not have done that, and you should reimburse the state, the federal campaign for that, or you know, the state, you should pay that back. So it may be a completely different view of this, but it goes back to saying only to the extent that we can show that the federal campaign inappropriately benefited by expenditures from the state campaign, will we then say there has to be a transfer of funds?
And my concern is that I hear what you say. I mean, I think that this is complicated by the fact that the records that we would ideally want that would establish, you know, to everyone's satisfaction, what was done here are, to the extent they exist, they would probably be within the control of the state committee. And normally we would, and as Commissioner Peterson accurately pointed out, you know, the state committee doesn't have a record-keeping requirement that we have jurisdiction to enforce. So it puts us in an awkward situation, because there's no way that, I mean, the whole purpose of an audit is to go look at their records, and they need to produce those records. We don't have the records. There's no way for our auditors to establish something without the records that are supplied by the candidate that we're auditing. And if they don't come up with the records, then we're sort of, we've got nothing to go on. So if we say, well, you know, if the candidate doesn't come up with the records, then, you know, we're just out of luck. That kind of leaves us I hear what you're talking about with the, you know, with the fact that we don't have jurisdiction to make them keep certain state records, but it also leaves us in kind of an uncomfortable place, because as I think Larry was trying to point out, you can be Larry the lawyer, as opposed to Joe the auditor, we are, you know, this isn't an enforcement action, it's an audit, and the whole purpose of an audit is to look at their records. And, you know, it's not a fishing expedition, it's what an audit is to look through their records. If they don't have records, then it makes it impossible for us to draw any conclusions at all.
But you just said what I was trying to say. If they don't have records, it makes it impossible for us to draw conclusions. So if we don't have records, we don't have records.
If I could just, you know, I think the issue you're talking about is one that we actually talked about in our meeting today, is what happens in a case like this where we have a, you know, a committee that says, you know, we ask, okay, we don't think that you allocated appropriately, and they come back and said, no, activities and expenditures which benefited the state committee were paid with state dollars, and vice versa, those that benefited the federal committee were paid with federal dollars. And that's in the reports, and there's your answer. And when we come back and say, well, we're still not comfortable with that, we don't necessarily have a lot of documentation to prove that, but I mean, what happens in that standoff? I mean, where do the presumptions lie in that case? And it appears that the presumption in this case was, well, we presume that there was something, that there was federal activity that needed to be either paid with all hard dollars, or at least with an allocated, allocation between federal and state dollars. But what is our basis for that presumption? We have a state committee here that they didn't have a record-keeping requirement, and we're kind of asking them to prove a negative now, and produce those, or we're going to assume that that was either federal, all federal, or at least that there should have been an allocation, and then the allocation formula we come up here with here in this instance, which I believe was around 75% to 80% of those expenditures, which what were considered shared expenditures, we kind of did a 80-20 federal state split. And I just, the evidence that I see presented in the audit report, I just, to me, does not seem to reflect that was justified, or I there's no basis for me to conclude that allocation reflected the reality of the situation. So
how about an affidavit? I mean, it seems to me that, you know, maybe we could get an affidavit from somebody who was from either the candidate or from somebody who was working in his state office saying no federal work was done here during this time period. We were exclusively operating, exclusively functioning on the benefit of a state campaign. And I mean, that would be probative. Do we ever explore options like that when they don't have records?
People do occasionally give us affidavits when we ask questions that we didn't specifically ask for one in this case, but none was proffered. One of the things that they have to sort of look at with this in the way it switched from being in their view, one day it was 100% state operation, the next day it was 100% federal operation. Probably didn't happen that quickly. Obviously the standard is benefit reasonably expected to be derived. There's no, that's the rule. That's what we have to look at. And in some cases, based on what we were looking at in documentation, you could say, well, it's okay, this is the way this one should be done. In other cases, and it's particularly with salaries and overhead operations, there's nothing other than the fact that we know that there were salaries and there was overhead and there was a phone bill and internet access and whatever else went with it, and that both campaigns were running. And so we were looking for a benefit reasonably expected to be derived. Now, obviously, it would be really great if we had time records for people or we had square footage records of who was occupying what in the office. Not there, and not surprised that that's not there. It's just not something that we'd have been shocked had we run into that sort of information. So then we were looking for a substitute for those kind of records that would have been the ideal. And the only one we could find was this fundraising. So that's what we did. I guess the question then becomes, if there are no records to support any of this, do we then just walk away and say, well, since there's no records, there can be no finding? I think that is somewhat dangerous because, failure to keep records then makes you finding proof, and I think this is not where we want to be.
I would like to also add that the funds received method, that only accounts for about 40,000 of the 84,000. The other 44,000 were either 100% or they were based on an allocation that the committee used after the election.
But the committee didn't use that.
They didn't use, right. they used it for something else. They used it on payroll, and we applied that payroll allocation to overhead, which they had originally put the overhead after the election. It went back to being paid by the state.
And that was a point in time, of course, when there was no longer a state campaign and he had been elected to the Congress. So going back to saying that the overhead is now all state campaign again didn't seem reasonable.
Once he was elected to Congress, there were still some expenditures for both the state and the federal.
Right, and that's why we use their allocation to allow for some state.
Trying to recognize that there was probably some wrap up activities involved with both.
Well, let's see. Do we have any motion? Just for myself, I would be willing to support a motion to go back and come back with some information to give us more intelligent debate. But I'm not ready to. A vote that we would adopt that formula based upon exactly what comes back, because I still think there's, I'd like to look a little more at some past history of what we've done and before I'd move off the theory that we've been using. But I'm open to a debate on it, but I'm not ready to do that today. So personally, in my view. Mr. Weintraub, any others?
Just sure. one final comment to address a concern that was raised earlier by Commissioner Weintraub. I don't view this as changing the standard. The standard, I believe it remains the same. Looking at the Schumer AO, there's language talking about how an allocation between when you have both state and federal campaigns sharing personnel and office space, that says it allocated on a number of bases reasonably reflecting the benefit derived. And the way I viewed this was that we should return this to audit to come back with us and show us what were the benefits derived by the state committee and what were the actual benefits derived by the federal committee, so that we can at least have a hard basis for making that determination. What I'm uncomfortable with is the formula that was used in this matter was actually rejected in Schumer, this fundraising allocation, just because, as the advisory opinion put it, there's a lot more going on here in fundraising. A ratio that makes sense in fundraising doesn't necessarily make sense in other contexts. And again, I realize kind of the quandary we were in this case, but I just personally couldn't sign off on a finding that I just have no confidence actually reflects what was the reality of what the actual benefits were to each of the two committees. And that's why I would recommend that we instruct the audit staff to go back and make a determination as to what the actual benefits were derived by each of the committees based on what, you know, whatever documentation we have.
Then do I read the motion to be that only? Because I read Commissioner Heiner had a little different spin on that, and I didn't mean it in a negative way, but that's the way I interpreted it, not to be exactly the same.
Well, I think, yeah, I think we're saying the same thing.
We've
I'm just trying
here.
To be clear that I think it will end up with a very different result, and I did tell you that earlier. I don't pretend to say that doing what Commissioner Peterson just suggested is going to be a minor change. I mean, that will completely change the audit report. So I said that earlier. I mean, that's my view of the way it should be, and I think we've explained our position. I'm not sure if you're saying, Mr. Vice Chair, that you don't want to support that now, or you want to think about it, or you never will support it.
Well, I think, and again, I'd like to go back to look at Schumer and some of those. If there's different types of approaches we can take, then certainly we can look at different types of approaches. But I don't think there's enough evidence today, from my perspective, to jump on one. And that's why I would be open to having information come back, but not be bound by the characterization that automatically. And I want to have some discussion on, okay, in this particular case, is this one that we can look at or not? I mean, I'm speaking out of ignorance right now. We don't know what we're going to get. I know what you think, probably right, but I'd like to see what it is.
Is your primary concern that you don't want to pre-commit yourself to saying whatever they come back with? We've already agreed in advance that we're going to accept that.
Right.
I would share the same sentiment.
Yeah, me too.
I see.
So,
yeah, sure.
If I can be clear, right. I think I understand you're saying your approach would be not to use an allocation at all in this case, and I think that concerns me. I think that, just for the record, I was fine with, I voted to approve this report, but we use allocations in many, many situations, and I think that in this case, when you've got two committees ongoing, that some allocation has to be possible because there are things going on. Now, in this case, if he was trying to sort of wait out the incumbent, that makes sense that he wouldn't have been doing anything but fundraising, and that to me actually seems why the fundraising allocation made some sense. If that's all he was doing, then that was the benefit being derived and expected to be derived from the activities. If the only activities were fundraising, it seems to me that allocation made some sense. But I'm not prepared to send this back and say not use, you know, to ignore all of our allocations. If we want to ask audit to prepare, you suggest some alternative allocation formulas or some alternative rationales, you know, I might be willing to look at other reports going forward. But I'm not willing to vote for something that says send it back, only count the activity that you actually have paper documentation for, because I just don't think that to me is changing the standard.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Let me try this. And by the way, I'm not completely unsympathetic to, you know, what you're seeing here. You know, I think it's what my frustration is mostly that, you know, we're arguing about something that I'm convinced it is possible to determine the facts of, and we don't seem to have those facts, and that's just, you know, so we're arguing about what we should assume about the facts that we don't know, and that I think probably are somehow ascertainable, even if we don't have those facts before us right now. But I think the concern on our side is that we want to be clear that whatever we're doing here, we are not adopting a new legal standard. So, I mean, maybe one way of doing this would be to have a formal vote on what's in front of us. That will fail, you know, to approve the audit report, and that will fail. And then we could have a vote to send it back to audit to develop a fuller factual record and to explore alternative methods of determining, trying to figure out how to say this without using the word allocation.
Don't use the word, right.
of determining where the cost should lie with the state committee or with the federal committee, see what other facts can be developed. And then we'll reconsider it after we get that back without saying anything about what the legal standard is. Just we're sending them back for more facts, more theories if they've got them, whatever they can come up with.
That would be one that I would support too, because until we have more facts, I think it's premature to ask us to jump on any particular other alternative approach. But I'm not sure if we're there yet, so.
I think that's a constructive suggestion, and I appreciate the spirit in which it's offered. I realize we've already kept you over by almost an hour, Mr. Vice Chairman, but could we maybe just talk about this for maybe just like 5 minutes, just to make sure. Sometimes when I'm thinking out loud on the dais, I might say or do something that
may come back to a
regretful, but if we could do that, I'd appreciate that.
Sure. We're adjourned for 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Recess, thank you. It's longest 5 minutes I've ever seen. I think it's probably time to get started again. That's where we are. We're going to resume the session, and Commissioner Peterson, do you have some thoughts on how to refine our discussions into something we can all agree on?
I have some thoughts, and I appreciate the informal dialogue that we had here, and for that extended 5 minutes that you.
FEC 5.
That's right. It's different than a normal.
It's like a New York minute.
I would be comfortable instructing the audit staff to go back and to revise a report, kind of consistent with the discussion we've had here at the table, to come back. I mean, we've heard concerns about. Documentation to come back and show us for which expenses can you show that there was actual benefit derived, and we have documentation, whether derived by the federal committee or the state committee, which expenditures are, or is there a presumption being built in, just so that we can have a better idea of exactly for which expenditures do we have hard proof? Do we have some sort of documentation? And which are we just guessing because we think that there might be a problem there? Those are some of the instructions that I would hope to.
I could support that. And thank you, Mr. Weintraub.
Two things. One, I would like to make a motion, which I know will fail, to approve the audit report as is. Two. Is there, and I'm asking both Joe and Larry this one, is there any reason we could not go back to the committee and ask them if, be frank with them, say, there's concern, we're not sure what to do with this issue. Is it possible that you could allay the concerns of the commission by providing us with a one-sentence affidavit from somebody who is in a position to know that this office was only used for state purposes and no federal activity took place there? I mean, that really would, one sentence would solve the whole thing for me.
Yes, ma'am.
When you're talking about an affidavit, would you just be talking about that period from 2003 to 2004? Because we are also allocating after the election.
Is there an agreement on that allocation? That particular, I got the impression there was, but is that not so? There's not. Okay. So
whatever period is in dispute.
Right.
Is there any reason we can't do that?
No legal reason we can't do that.
And I want to be clear. I'm not asking to send people back to go rooting around through their records again. I'm not asking for anybody here to go anywhere. Just to ask them if they can produce a very brief affidavit that would allay some commissioners' concerns.
Then the motion, if I understand it, would be that we will have a motion to, first of all, there'll be a motion to accept the recommendations.
I don't have a full appreciation, of how this all works. So I don't want to, when I say I can't support that, it's not because it's not a good idea, it's not because that would be helpful information, but we're here at the final stage. This has been going on for a long time. I don't know why that wasn't already done. I don't know specifically if the question was asked. I do know that a federal report was filed on, I think it's under penalty of perjury and you have to swear it, right? So I mean, would they have filed with the federal government and the state government their reports?
And I don't know that it makes a whole lot of sense to go back and get any additional information at this point.
Well, nobody raised a concern about this before, which is why it was not addressed earlier. You've raised a concern. I think it's a valid concern. And I'm just asking if we can go back and see if they can do something very, very simple to allay the concern.
But I understand that if the answer is no, we can't, then we'll go ahead with this process. And I think, and maybe you don't want an inquiry. I don't know. I would suggest that we just send it back to audit, and they'll be communicating, I suppose, to some degree, and say the commissioners are interested to know if there's an affidavit that could be offered that can resolve it. If not, we're going to. And actually, you don't have to go back because you're not going to look at any records unless you can't understand what's on a receipt, I suppose. But as I understand it, we're not going to go looking for new documents. We're going to look only at the documents that we've been relying on already and have. So, Commissioner, would you like to see if you want to embellish that approach? I mean, I guess we would restate the motion, but I didn't mean to cut you off.
Restate the approach you just discussed?
Yes. I mean, I think I understand what the concerns are, but I don't know if we are capturing your agreement.
Okay. I think... the way I would structure the motion is that is what we did earlier, and I don't know that that would get four votes needed to move forward. And that was to instruct the audit staff to go back and only report back to us the benefit derived, am I saying it the right way? The benefit derived for the expenditures that we have evidence to show should have been paid for with all or in part federal funds. I mean, and that's what it's always been for us, and apparently I'm not sure if we're going to get support for that. If not, maybe we just vote 3-2 and call it a day.
Can I just ask you why, what your objection is to asking, just going back and asking one simple question that would clarify the whole issue?
I'd like to point out that the recommendation in the interim audit report, we did pretty much ask for that. We had a very elaborate recommendation asking for any information about who did what for the state versus federal. So it's not like we didn't try to get them, and the affidavits would have been fine, but they basically gave us legal arguments and a little bit of documentation. So, I mean, it's been asked.
Well, I'm willing to, you know, in the audit context, people probably assume that what we're looking for is some record of, you know, like phone bills and, you know, the kind of records that auditors usually look at. Auditors don't right. usually look at affidavits. They usually look at other kinds of records. So I'm willing to, I believe you that you asked something that might have elicited that if, you know, but, you know, perhaps if we ask them more directly, we might be able to get a simple piece of paper that would just make the whole problem go away. Because I don't necessarily disagree with you that, you know, maybe they did use it all for state purposes. I can conceive of a circumstance where they really wouldn't have any federal office. But I just can't tell from what we know now. I'm not willing to make that assumption that. And of course, people file reports with us all the time, but if we were just going to say, well, it must be right because they already filed a report with us, then we would never do any audits at all.
I would like to add that the committee did submit one affidavit. They had submitted an affidavit for one of the employees that was after the election. So they had submitted an affidavit to us.
And what did that affidavit say?
If I recall, it basically said that she volunteered after the election. This is someone who had been federal the whole time, then became state.
And
we did not accept that affidavit. In the audit.
We did not accept it?
No.
What does that mean?
There were other factors that contributed to showing that she had participated federally, and so we did not accept her affidavit that she had only volunteered after she had been completely 100% federal.
I guess I'm not really sure I understand what you're saying.
Well, the point was is you didn't believe the affidavit.
Well, can I just ask a follow-up? So she was being paid after the election.
She was being paid by the state.
She was being paid a salary.
By the state.
Okay, and
she said she volunteered.
She said she was doing volunteer work for the federal campaign at the same time.
Right.
And your assessment was because she had been paid federally up until the date of the election, she must have still been, she must have been still doing the federal work as a salaried employee rather than a volunteer.
We did have two different approaches here. I mean, one of which, if you ask for an affidavit, you then, to some degree, end up shifting the burden of proof, and I'm not too sure that's where we're going to find a final agreement here. But
it's not a burden of proof, it's a burden of production.
Well, if the question is, have you provided us all the records you have available, that's one thing. But if you ask them to say, regardless of the records that are available to, and we can't produce, and here's the way I interpret them, that it's a little bit different. Well, what I understand is that we're going to look at what we have, if nobody's going to be willing to sign an affidavit, and see, because I guess what statements we already have under oath, and see where they will take us. And we haven't decided to agree, we're not agreeing on where they'll take us until we have more detail. Joe,
as far as the affidavit go, I would be very surprised if they wouldn't provide such an affidavit, because it would be consistent with the way they reported things and what they've been arguing all along. I don't know that we know any more then than we know now, but
would we accept it?
I'm sure that they would be willing. I'm sure, you know, if the commission wants it, I'm sure they would do it. I'm just not certain that it adds much to to what we already know, because I mean, the committee's been arguing all along that,
point.
You know, up through this date it was all state, and then from this date to this date it was all federal, and then from this date to this date it was something else.
Lawyers' arguments and affidavits have different weights, you know. And I mean, from my perspective, you know, I've seen a lot of lawyers who can spin a lot of theories about what might have been and could have happened, and I know very well that there's a difference, and the lawyers who are out there know very well that there's a difference between a lawyer's argument and something that you back up with an affidavit. And if you can back it up with an affidavit, you know it's going to carry more weight. And if you think that they would be willing to supply an affidavit saying, I mean, because it seems to me that what we're arguing about is overhead. You know, did they have, was some of this overhead that they paid out of the state campaign, should it have been allocated to the federal? And if they are willing to supply us with an affidavit that says, we didn't do any federal work in this office from this date to that date, I'm done. You know, that satisfies me. My problem is that right now we've got an absence of records, and we're arguing about, well, what does that mean? You know, who has the burden, and what presumption should we determine from that? That would be probative. Joe seems to think we can get it.
But I also just heard that may not change the equation for the audit staff.
Changes it for me. I get a vote.
And I also think that there's a difference when there's contradictory evidence. And here, there, as Commissioner Weintraub pointed out, there's an absence. There's clearly some federal activity going on. There was a poll, there was fundraising, there was federal activity going on. It doesn't necessarily have to have taken place in that office with respect to overhead. When you've got contradictory evidence that an affidavit, you know, can't stand up against, that's one thing. But here there isn't any.
Well, but that makes my point, is how do we ever come up with this finding if there's no evidence that there was any federal activity going on?
When there's federal activity going on, we have a reg that says you have to look at the benefit derived, and there's an ongoing federal campaign. There has to, and it's raising money, and it has a poll in the field, and there's all kinds of things that are being...
But there's no evidence that there was any benefit derived from, by virtue of running that state office.
Right. We know there was federal activity. We just
right.
don't know where it was.
We don't know that anything was run out of the state office. We don't have any evidence of that.
Well, we don't have any evidence of where else it was either. We have an absence of evidence. Therefore, if we got a one-sentence affidavit, we would have some evidence that leaned one way, and we would have nothing contradicting it. And I guarantee you, I promise you, I commit to you, that if we get that affidavit, I will be there with you, you know, in terms of voting to say, fine, no allocation required. Good deal.
may I ask one
question? I should
question?
Be quiet while I can, huh?
May I
yes,
ask one
right.
question?
Go ahead.
Please, I'm looking for a fact. I think this is the case, that when he filed his federal candidacy with the FEC, He used the same office address as his state campaign. Is that correct?
They're not the same addresses on the state reports as they are on the federal reports, but the rent, the address on the federal report is the address that was paid, the state report paid rent to. And I have documentation that the original, I wasn't the original auditor on this case. And I talked with the original auditor, and he said he had spoken, I assume he had spoken with the committee, because he had stated that the federal and the state campaigns were run from the same office space. But they don't have the same addresses on the state report as well as the federal report.
Okay, but they were run from the same place.
Our information.
Their filing address wasn't the same.
Correct. The address on the state reports appears to be the address of one of the employees, the treasurer.
And what was the basis for his belief that they were operating out of the same place?
I believe he asked them. The auditor did.
Yeah, Gary asked them, and they said they ran it out of the same office space, both offices, both campaigns.
He asked the committee.
Well, that sort of changes things.
Well, I'm not exactly sure where we were. I thought we had an understanding that we take our documents and go back. I think the idea of an affidavit could be problematic because we don't know what it's going to say. And to me, the best evidence in most cases is documentation. And if we begin to substitute that for affidavits, we've got to be prepared for the consequences of that.
All the time.
Sometimes we do that, but I'm not convinced that in a case like this where we have documents that are out there going both ways, that we just say, well, we'll ignore them. And you tell me. And one of the issues that comes up is that at what point can you insist that somebody give you an affidavit?
We're not insisting. We're just asking.
Well, I know. But if they don't, then where are we? Because we're...
Then we'll be back where we are. You know, there's one alternative is they provide us with the affidavit and, you know, we're great. We've resolved the entire thing. The other alternative is they don't provide us with the affidavit, and then, you know, we're no worse off than we are now. We're basically back in the same place. How about if I do this, because I know what the result of this one will be. How about if I get out of the way the motion to, you know, approve the audit report as is? I know it'll fail, but let's just, you know, that we'll have our votes on the record, and we'll just get that one out of the way.
Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Vice Chairman, I move that we approve the report of the Audit Division on the Cool for Congress Committee, AO5-15, as set forth in Agenda Document 08-35.
Okay, we have such a motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
All right, now we're...
Darn.
Yeah. Do you want to take a shot at it?
I suppose I could move... to instruct the staff to revise a report consistent with the discussion at the table and divine what you think that means. I think that would be, we could come.
That's fine.
When we talked about the projected range in sampling, I can only imagine what the projected range of interpretations of what we've said at this table might be. That could be a little dangerous, but.
I hope nobody ever has to review this transcript.
I would be willing to move that we instruct audit staff to revise the final audit report consistent with what we've said here at the table, where we've requested that the
maybe you should just stop there.
Okay, I probably should. But in terms of the matter that Commissioner Hunter and I are most concerned about is having documentation of actual benefit derived by each of the committees and what proof we have for that, and that's an element that we would very much want to see in a final report. And I will let Caroline modify the motion to any extent that she wishes to.
Let's see how that goes.
Well, I'll support that myself.
Let me just, trying to get to yes with you, I really am. Okay.
Can I just add one point, just to address a concern that the Vice Chairman has raised, that we aren't pre-committing ourselves to what that report would look like, that when it comes back to us, we aren't saying now that we'll approve whatever we see, but we're instructing them to bring that back to us, at which point we'll then consider it.
And we're not instructing them to go out and do further investigations.
Just get a more detailed submission.
Could we modify that so that that's not the exclusive subject matter of whatever they bring back to us? Because originally I heard you say that in an earlier iteration you were talking about bringing back the documentation for the actual benefit as well as backup for any presumptions that they were making and how much was presumed and how much was actual. And it was it sounded like we were gathering a broader range of information. We're not doing that anymore.
My only thought is, suppose there is something that, okay, it's not a check, but it's a memo that suggests something like, I mean, it may not be exact expenditure, but suggests like we need more room in here now for the campaign or something, where you see that there's some sharing going on at the same time. I'm just throwing something out. I saw a negative shake of the head, but it seemed to me that'd be probative.
Well, in cases where there's some sort of document, I would not consider that necessarily contradictory to my motion, because in that case, that would be documentation, and that would be some basis for arriving at a conclusion of actual benefit, and so on. Right. So yeah, I'm. What I'd like to see is, you know, what documentation do we have, and you know what backing can we provide in a revised report to show what were the expenditures that where we can show that there was an actual benefit derived.
Does Otto understand this?
I should modify it to say that Otto is not only permitted but encouraged to follow up with any questions along the way.
Mr. Stoltz, how do you feel about that approach? Can you, are you get enough guidance from that?
What we can do is go back and provide the commission, I guess, a lot more detail to look at. And
see where it takes us.
Yeah, see where it takes you.
Of course. Commissioner Barrelly.
Thank you. I'd be happy to vote for a motion as Mr. Stoltz just outlined. I can't support something that just says come back with the result that of the actual expenses, because I think that approach of only looking at that set of information as opposed to saying bring us back with more detail so we can assess what things may have been in your approach actual benefit, and then looking also at things that were allocated and to see if we think that might be acceptable, that to me changes the entire approach. And that's too narrow of, I think, an instruction for me to be able to support.
As I read it, it's something that's probative to an allocation issue that is something other than just speculation, is something to take a look at. Right? Do you read it that way?
We'll,
to the extent there's anything like that.
Provide in a lot more detail than we did in the report. We normally do in a report. What our theory was behind each one of the disbursements that are allocated. Now, obviously, if we get the overhead, that'll just be a pool of things and say include the following. And you know, that's that. For the rest of it, whatever information we have, we'll try to describe in a lot more detail so that.
And the way I understand it, we're not bound by how we're going to shake out, how we're going to resolve the issue, but we'll just have more to go on.
I think we're willing to just take a look at what the way Joe just described it. It's not what we originally intended, but it's clear that some commissioners aren't comfortable with what we originally intended. What we're trying to do is maybe get more than two votes. So we're still try, and we'll see what audit comes back with. And if it's, I mean, just to be very honest, if it's the same thing that we already got with just a little bit more explanation, I'm not like, I am almost certain to not approve it. So we could end up right where we are, but we're hoping that we might get an extra vote or two, and we'll see.
And as a point of clarification, can they, sorry, thank you. Can they ask for the affidavit?
I think at this point, based on what the vice chairman said in our thinking on this, is this is at the final end. It's not that we're opposed to it or we think it's a bad tactic, but in this case, at the end of the process, the issue's been raised, and I just don't think it
might get you an extra vote at the end of the day. I understand that it might not make a difference to you.
What's the might?
No, it well, depending on what it says.
That's what we don't know.
No, if it said yes,
federal campaign out of here all the time.
Yes, that would
that
be a problem.
That might have to get us some votes the other way.
That would be a problem.
Well, there was no hedging before.
No, if they say that they didn't do any federal activity out of this office, I guarantee you my vote. Now, wouldn't you like to have my vote?
I would. I absolutely would.
Well, we can't go downhill. So let's figure that wherever we go, we'll come out with a more meaningful decision. Are we ready for a vote as modified by Commissioner Peterson, as modified by Commissioner Hinn, as modified by Commissioner Weintraub and Commissioner Merrily, and explained by the staff director? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? I think that's going to be it. Mr. Staff Director, are there any additional management or administrative matters to discuss?
No, sir, there are not.
Okay, the meeting is adjourned.